I'm telling you, heaven just got a little more rocking. A lot of musicians have
it's
passed.
Been a big month for them up there.
It's totally.
It really has.
Not even finished dealing with the death of David Bowie.
Natalie Cole, David Bowie, everyone in Celine Dion's family, although that kind of doesn't count, I guess.
You know how they say that people hang on through the holidays?
And yes.
Then, yeah.
And yes.
I just thought of that when I've been hearing these names.
Isn't that crazy?
I have two more for you.
Two more? Well, that's, the drummer from Mott the Hoople.
Well, that's one of them.
That's one of them.
His name is Dale Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
And Bowie's here's the weird thing. Mott the Hoople, all the young dudes.
Yeah.
David Bowie singing on it.
Yep.
There's a connection there.
Yeah.
Isn't that strange?
It is strange.
Aladdin
is.
Sane, right? Was that the album? Or
is it the album? I can't remember. It could be.
I think it's the album. I think that the song's
that
on
makes
Bowie,
sense.
Yeah.
I bet it is.
All right, so he sings backup on that, so that's the connection there. And I have another connection for you if you want it.
What is it?
There's another dude who...
All the young.
Boy, it's all coming full circle.
It all ties in.
Dallas Taylor passed away on the 18th. He was the drummer for Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young.
Oh, wow.
Pretty great super group.
Yeah.
And he has a song called Fallen Eagle.
Oh.
Which is Glenn
wow.
Frey. How weird is this?
That's very strange.
Gary Loizzo, of course, from Bend Me, Shape Me, the American Breed we talked about yesterday.
Right.
Was Bowie waiting there at the pearly gates for Glenn Frey? Come on, dude.
It's possible, I imagine. What Steve said, I give some credence to. Nobody in Creedence has died, by
the way.
No,
CCR, we're still good.
Where,
good
although you might have just doomed them.
I hope I didn't. But I have my whole life heard that phrase, somebody was hanging on to the holidays, and you go, oh, that's impossible. That's not going to happen. My wife told me a story yesterday. You know, she works with, she teaches improv at senior citizen centers.
She is an awesome wife.
Without a doubt, the best that's ever
been. Everybody in your family so nice and caring and charitable?
No one can explain that. Nobody knows. But she was telling me a story about one of the people that she has been working with who died one day short of his 100th birthday.
Oh.
He missed his 100th birthday by one day.
I bet I know why.
Why?
He thought the date, he got the dates messed up.
Maybe that's what it is.
My brother got married, a million years ago, and my grandma was battling breast cancer, and she was at Edgewood or Edgewater Hospital. It's way far north.
Yeah.
So we all went to see her the weekend before the wedding, and she kept saying to my brother, how much money did you get? Did you get a lot at your wedding? And we're like, Nina, Chris didn't get married yet. She died that night.
Oh.
We had all seen her. She really thought the wedding already happened.
How about that?
So this guy must have had, you know, he didn't, you know how if there's a month that doesn't have 31 days, your watch is all screwed up.
Maybe that's what it is.
That's what happened, poor guy.
Are you a subscriber to this theory? And we see this, it pops up in the news a couple times a year about some couple that's been together for 71 years and they die within 9 minutes of each other. Like one of them goes and the other one goes, well, what's left for me? I don't need to be here anymore. And then they just go. How about that?
That's going to be you.
It just happened to a celebrity's parents, didn't it? In Florida, I'm trying to...
Did it?
Doug Flutie.
Doug Flutie.
It was Doug Flutie's parents. The dad, right. I think, had a heart attack, and within, like, 6 hours later, the mom died.
Yeah,
that's
really?
Exactly what I was thinking of.
Really?
I read your mind. All right, you know what? I am so sick of Facebook and all the internet and interwebs. Call misinformation. Just call me misinformation from now on.
Good morning, Misinformation. How are you?
Good, sir. How are you?
Wendy has the sash on, Cole. You should see the sash. It's lovely.
I bet it looks hot on her. I'm afraid that I fell for the Dallas Taylor thing, too. It was a year ago.
Can you believe this?
That keeps happening on Facebook all the time
it
now.
It does. It like the Larry Lujack thing right before Christmas.
Right.
And Bob Denver has
Bob
died
Denver
how many
last
times?
Week. Everybody yes, exactly. I talked to this week, how
it's
about Bob Denver?
Don't you think it's a change of the year? So people...
I guess.
No, I think when somebody dies, somebody else posts it, and then it becomes, you know, on everybody's newsfeed, and, you know...
They see people, they died January 2nd, 2015.
Yeah, that's what this
And they're
was.
Like, oh, that's this year.
I'm just getting in a feed now. It says Millard Fillmore has passed away.
No.
There's no way that could be right.
But Abe Vigoda is still alive.
Very much alive.
God, I hope he remains alive because his name has been brought up on this show. Although I don't think anything can kill him.
No.
We thought he's been gone, I did, for several years.
Live and kicking.
Bernice.
I think, I think there's a website that attests to his existence almost every day. You can check it if you want.
That's beautiful. Thanks, Cole. Appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for misinformation. And misinformation again, Mike. What did I do again?
Oh, no, nothing wrong. Just adding to it that David Bowie wrote the lyrics and produced Not the Hoople's album.
It all does tie in.
It does, yeah, and I should have known that.
He wrote the lyrics to it and produced it and blah, blah, blah.
And he wrote another song that he gave to Mott the Hoople, too, that I cannot remember right now.
Yeah, neither can I right now, and I'm still driving a truck, and I can't look it up.
Okay, well, we'll look it up for you.
I'm with the daughter that parks in the middle of the driveway with her truck.
Well, that's right, from a week or so ago. That's right. We remember. All right. Well, thank you. Thanks,
Mike.
You
too. Thank you.
Could you explain the name of that band to me? Because my whole life I've heard the name of the band, and I don't understand it. Who is Mott, and what is a hoople?
I don't know that there has to be an explanation.
They just came up with words? They just threw words down?
I think, you know, you want to do a whole VH1 Behind the Music, because when we talked to Stephen Tobolowsky yesterday and you brought up the Radiohead connection, what a great story.
I had heard that years and years and years ago. Somebody, and I don't remember who, was telling me he had, oh boy, who was it? He had like four or five of these unbelievable stories about the world of music. And one of them was that this actor, this obscure actor, Stephen Tobolowsky, is the reason Radiohead has their name. And I heard it, and I'm like, oh, that's a great story, but I don't think that's true.
I know, because you asked me off the air, and I'm like, I don't know. I have never heard that.
He verified it, that every once in a while, for people who didn't hear the interview, he hears a tone in his head, and then he hears some interesting, like, inside fact about the person in his head, and it turns out to be true. He told the story about his teacher, that his teacher was using a fake name, that he figured out he heard a tone and heard this guy's real initials are this, and he confronted him, and it was accurate. But that I
and then David Byrne took that information and put, they made that song, he wrote that song Radiohead about
because of this.
Stephen Tobolowsky.
Yeah.
And then the members of Radiohead were called something else, but they loved David Byrne, so they kind of took that song title to
right.
be. How weird is that?
Insane. Crazy.
I mean, I'll find out the Mott the Hoople story for you.
Also, I'm on Facebook. Julius Caesar has died. That just came in on Facebook. We're going to take a quick break. We have a big show. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN. It's Bill F. and it's Wendy Snyder. The music world has lost another great. We're trying to figure out why on Facebook they keep letting us know that people have died who really died 3 or 4 years ago.
I know, because somebody just said, did Glenn Frey really die? Yes, he did.
He just did, yeah.
Of just a crazy combination of
pneumonia, colitis, and something
rheumatoid arthritis, yeah. Colitis, and they're thinking that since those two things are immune deficiency diseases, that's how he developed pneumonia. Only 67 years old. Then Mott the Hoople drummer Griffin, Dale Griffin died. He for sure died 67. This was announced 15 hours ago. We just heard all the young dudes from Mott the Hoople. But then I mentioned Dallas Taylor, who was the drummer for Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, but he died a year ago.
Yeah, we were just informed by a listener that happened at least a year ago. So here's a theory. I could be right, I could be wrong. Let me just throw it out there. I think now it has become a game for people to just throw it out on Facebook, to mention somebody who died 4 or 5 or 6 years ago and put it out there on Facebook and go, isn't it sad that we have lost Jim Backus? Isn't that terrible? That Jim Backus is gone. So then people will hear that and go, I loved him. That was Mr. Howell. That was Mr. Magoo. Jim Backus is gone. And everybody will just kind of piggyback on that. Is that a possibility?
I think that is a very good possibility. I also think you mentioned this on the air or off the air, but you said it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
On your Facebook feed, all of a sudden it'll say memories from 1 year ago and something will pop up that you posted
right.
a year ago or 4 years ago. And maybe, because it was in January of last year that Dallas Taylor died, so maybe it resurfaced on someone else's feed and then
right.
everyone's seeing it to be true.
Right. But now here's the downside of that. It's very possible in some of these cases, like the one that happened over Christmas was Larry Lujak, that the radio legend Larry Lujak had died when in reality he died over a year ago. But for some reason, it was all over Facebook, and I saw so many messages everywhere about Larry Lujak.
Oh, so sad to hear this news. But, where were you a year ago, people?
Right. But don't you think there's a percentage of people who say, wow, I got to send the Lujak family some condolences. I have to send Mrs. Lujak a little card saying how much I'll miss her husband. So that's got to be weird to all of a sudden get notices a year or so later. That's not good. I mean, it's nice to have some appreciation right. that way, but then you go, oh, well, that's the timing on this is quite off.
Mott the Hoople, by the way, where did it get its name? From RapidCityJournal.com. Mott the Hoople refers to the popular British band of the early 70s that took its name from the mid-60s book of the same name written by Willard Manis.
I'm not familiar with the book, are you?
No. The book was published, what about the Steve Bertrand Reading Club or whatever he calls it, his book club? Manis's book was published in 1966. It didn't sell well. It wound up in the hands of record producer Guy Stevens, who in 1969 was working at the time with a band called Silence.
They were too quiet for my liking.
Liking the title
of the book. Some of their CDs, and I kept turning the volume up. It's like, come on, guys, do something.
I love how we left a moment of silence after we said
did
that.
In honor
good
of them.
Planning. Liking the title of the book, the band changed its name to Mott the Hoople. I forgot Ian Hunter was the singer of that band. And
oh.
David Bowie wrote, David Bowie persuaded the group to reform and record a song he'd written called All the Young Dudes.
A great song. A beautiful song.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so Glenn Frey is dead. Mott the Hoople drummer. What's his name?
Was it Jeff something?
Griffin.
Is it Jeff Griffin?
Dave Griffin.
Dave Griffin.
I'll find
Peter
out.
Peter Griffin.
He's barely gone. And
I know. I'm sorry.
That's
but
how quickly it happens.
Glenn Frey takes precedence.
I know,
you know.
And it shouldn't be that way.
So, right. We'll talk about him next year on
you
Facebook.
Know, you know what it's like? I hate to equate this, but it's true. You'll see this at the Academy Awards. You see it at the Emmys when they do that in memoriam segment. And certain celebrities get a lot more response and applause than others, proving that even in death, everything's a popularity contest.
Right. You don't want to be a dead makeup artist at the Oscars.
Right.
Good advice.
Because somebody's going to get more response right. than you.
Dale Griffin, by the way.
Dale Griffin.
Of course.
Dale Buffin Griffin. Buffin was his nickname.
Yeah.
All right. Greg, happy sad day to you.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great. What's up, Greg?
I was kind of in a Bowie mood over the weekend, and actually bought his new Black Star album. That thing is amazing.
Is it good? Yeah.
Went to number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, is it really? Well,
yeah.
It's just the Lazarus song and the whole nine yards. But anyhow, when I was over the weekend, I was watching a VH1 episode from back when Bowie was on this, acoustic one, whatever it was called, Behind the Music, whatever. Anyhow, he was telling the story of the Mott the Hoople song and mentioned that he created another song called Always Crashing in the Same Car, wrote it for Mott the Hoople, and they decided, he goes, something to the effect of, in their infinite wisdom, decided not to record it.
Hmm.
He was in Florida, he got really drunk, and he shaved his eyebrows off. And he goes, that really taught them a lesson. It was just something to that effect. It was hilarious just how he shared that story, but just that he had written another song. They didn't record it, but then he ended up playing it on the VH1 show.
Oh, yeah? Oh, that's great.
That is great.
That's perfect. Well, thank you, Greg. Appreciate it.
But yeah, that Black Star album, amazing.
It's worth it, huh? All right, good. We'll find it. We'll listen to it. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Take care.
We need some WD-40.
You can hear my chair, right?
It sounds like there is a goose in here.
Well, there is also a goose in here, but this is my chair. But I did bring a goose. It's Bring Your Goose to Work Day.
Get some WD-40. Seriously, that stuff is amazing. Our door hinge in our bathroom door off of our bedroom was, every time Jim would wake up in the middle of the night, he'd mm-hmm. open that door and it would wake me up. It was that loud.
The same noise.
Little WD-40.
All right.
Pretty
amazing. We'll get some, I promise.
If not, I'll bring in my toolbox tomorrow.
Oh, that'll be fun. All right. A break, some news, a lot more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
I'm a brick house.
Are you a brick house?
How?
That's the only song that was ever written about the great Jack Brickhouse, I believe. I can't think of any others. Can you? That's the only one. You know, there's another radio station here in town that plays a game where you find a low gas price and then you call them and you tell them the low gas price.
I'm aware of that radio station.
You know that, Felicia. You're well aware of this.
Do you have a low gas price, Bill?
I do. I would like you to try to guess. I found this yesterday. I found it and I found it impossible to believe, but it's true. Guess the price of gas in Michigan as of yesterday.
$1.65.
47 cents.
What?
In Michigan.
They made a mistake, obviously.
They did not. And not, it's not like that at every gas station in Michigan, but Michigan was the first state, it says here, to report gas prices under a dollar. Yesterday, there was a place in Houghton Lake, Michigan. I don't know where in Michigan that is located. I'm sorry.
It's right next to the lake.
There. Is it by the lake?
Yeah, right.
The by lake. Houghton Lake?
Now, is this the lake they're using for water in Michigan? Because maybe they're giving you a discount on gas because you're all dying from typhoid from the water
That's
you're drinking.
That's possible. Actually, in Michigan, it's actually safer to just drink straight gasoline than it is tap water. That's the only state in the Union where you're better off just drinking gasoline.
That story, by the way, is really a travesty.
Oh,
we'll talk about that later.
Is it ever? Is it ever? All right. So in this town in Michigan, Houghton Lake, Michigan, 47 cents a gallon. That's unbelievable.
But how, I mean.
And they, oh, go on.
No, but I mean, if you owned a gas station.
Right.
Couldn't you make up any price you wanted to try and get more business?
You can. And they're, I mean, they have long lines of people waiting in line. Throughout the rest of Michigan, it's just under a dollar. But at this particular gas station, 47 cents a gallon. But I believe you have autonomy. I believe you can just say, hey, it's my gas station. 9 cents a gallon. Come on in. See what happens.
Because on the way in the neighborhoods that don't have a lot of money, the gas is way more expensive than in suburbs,
yeah.
Which I think is just mean
it's
and rude.
It's a little backwards. It's a little backwards.
So how does this 47 cents?
Michigan, it says, all right, the price of gas has hit a stunning low. It's 47 cents per gallon in parts of Michigan this on Sunday. Michigan was the first state to have gas under a dollar in over a decade. Patrick DeHaan, senior petroleum analyst at GasBuddy.com, told that's their sounder told ABC News a gas station in Houghton Lake, Michigan, the one I was telling you about, hit the price, the miracle price of 47 cents, marking a price war between the three stations in town. See, that's what goes on. You've seen this at intersections sometimes where there's two or three or
yeah.
There was one when I was growing up that had four. Each of the corners had a gas station on it. And if one would lower the price by 8/10 of a cent or 9/10 of a cent, you'd see the guy across the street go down another 9/10 of a cent.
That's what you got to do. Someone suggested we called them because they're sure it's not that today.
I would imagine it's gone up a little bit. Can you buy, does anyone have the right, like, can you buy, I don't know how you would do this. You'd have to store it somewhere. Could you go in and say, I want to buy 100 gallons of gas and just keep it somewhere? I don't know how that would work.
No.
You can't do that, can you?
I think that is illegal.
Because
what if, yeah, I think so. Because
it's dangerous.
You have to have the proper container.
Yeah.
And where would
Although
you put
you could,
it in your basement? Because that's a fire hazard.
No, it would be. It would be. But I would love to secure. I wonder if you could work something out with them where you say, I'll pay for it up front, but I want to lock in this price for the next 6 months. They can't do that.
No, it's no. You don't get a rain check.
Do you remember Priceline, the one that William Shatner is the front man for? They used to have a thing where you could do something very similar to that, where you could lock in a price for gasoline for a certain amount of weeks or months. You would pay for it in advance, and you were locked in.
A Priceline, I thought, was just travel.
Mostly hotels and airfare, but for
gasoline
a little while they dealt
too?
In gasoline, yeah.
You're making that up.
No. If I was going to make something up, I'd go crazier than that.
Get the Shat on the phone.
Get William Shatner on, Kevin.
There's no way you got gasoline
him.
With Priceline?
You could, yeah, you would buy, essentially, you were buying gas futures, essentially, because you were, it was like you were predicting the marketplace. You would lock in at a certain price, and that's what you paid for 2 or 3 or 4 months. I don't lie about Shatner. That's the one thing that I hold near and dear. I do not lie about William Shatner.
Joe has a great question, and it echoes my sentiments. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, I'm curious as to how the oil companies are allowed to charge by a denomination of money that does not exist, the tenth of a cent.
That's a great question.
If say gas is 224.9 cents, and I buy exactly 1 gallon of gas,
yeah.
And I give them $2.25, how are they going to give me my change?
That is the best question ever.
It's the only product. Can you think of another product that charges in tenths of a cent? It's only gasoline. Why does that still exist?
Hogs.
Is it hogs?
I don't know.
All right.
That is the best question. Really, what if he gets 1 gallon? How
right.
are they going to put that on his credit card?
Right.
Better yet, if he gives cash, how do
right.
they give him change?
And is anyone swayed by a tenth of a cent? Like when you're driving, if you see one kind of gas station on one side of the road and the other on the, would you go, wow, they're 1/10 of a cent less. I'm going to that one.
Yeah, because it adds up for 12, you know, 15 gallons.
Then it's a difference of 12 or 15 cents. Is that worth it?
It's over a dollar.
Yeah.
Gas talk, 312-981-7200. Gas
noise.
Talk.
Can you do your noise? That's beautiful.
Oh, sorry.
That's the sound that pays. Everyone hung up when you made that noise.
No, Ray has a question, too, or a comment. Ray, hey, how's it going?
Hey, Southwest Airlines did that years ago. They locked in the price for the fuel, and that's why they were, I think they did it for several years, and that's why they were so successful in expanding their market, because they knew that they had a fixed gas price.
Well, didn't they?
Or fuel price, because that did a lot of, like Midway Airlines, remember that, or Kiwi?
Right.
That's what really did those things under when the Gulf War and all that came around.
Didn't Southwest somehow buy their own gas dispensary or something, I seem to remember? Does that sound right?
I think you're right with that. But, you know, I have commercial real estate. I buy natural gas in bulk like that, too.
I think you can do that with natural gas. I don't think you can do that with gasoline for your car, though. I don't think.
No. But, I mean, you know, there's things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure that's what Osco does. You know, they buy cheap if you're a member. That's why those prices are lower,
maybe.
Too.
Or Sam's Club does
something
similar.
Sam's Club has some great prices on gas.
Yeah.
I almost said glass. They buy
in bulk.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, guys.
Thank you.
Keep up the good show.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Ray.
Thank you. So, is he listening
to a different show?
Oh, okay. You mentioned the gas price in Houghton Lake. What was it yesterday?
It was yesterday. It was Sunday and Monday. They registered 47 cents per gallon in Houghton Lake, Michigan.
All right. We now go live to our reporter, Carol, who's in Houghton Lake, Michigan right now, or was. Hi, Carol.
Hi, and I'm not actually in Houghton Lake. I'm just looking at Gas Buddy.
Oh, what did they say about it today?
$1.57.9.
It went up $1.10 in a day?
Well, it wouldn't be the first time.
Wow. Even that is a really good price. That's a tremendous
Michigan's
price.
Yeah, usually pretty good. I'm up there fairly often.
Yeah.
So.
And somebody says it's illegal in Wisconsin to do the price fixing, like somebody just texted us. And let me read this to us. Wisconsin has a law that doesn't allow price wars on gas. It's supposedly to protect small businesses from being put out by businesses by bigger companies.
Oh, that makes sense. Well, Carol, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have
a great
good
day.
One.
Take care.
I don't know if that's the first time she went on Gas Buddy.
I don't know. We're opening up new horizons for people. A quick break. We've got, we're going to talk about Tech Tuesday stuff with CNET's Ian Schur in just a little bit. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
It is a Tech Tuesday, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And Bridget Carey, we usually speak to her when she is unavailable. We speak to Ashley Esqueda.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm excited to introduce to you a third CNET friend that we have, and we've talked to him before, Ian Schur. How are you, Ian?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Where is everybody? CNET's busy.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Hello?
Can you not hear us?
I can hear you just fine.
That's
okay.
Better.
No, I can hear you fine. Yeah, so no, I I'm glad to know that I'm the third on your list. That's always fun.
No, we've talked to you before. You're our third friend. We have three friends at CNET. You are executive editor at CNET News.
It shows how deep the lineup is.
Totally.
Every line is as strong as can be. That's a good thing, I think.
Exactly. There are many of us, and we're always happy to chat.
Yep. You're like a tech army, Ian. That's what we look at you as. That's what you are.
Well, I started logging on to CNET.com just because I was looking for tech products, and you guys do great reviews over there, and I only trust my downloads from CNET.com, so it's a great website. And what are we going to talk about today on this Tech Tuesday? What do you have for us?
Well, it's really interesting. I think there are some really fascinating things going on. Perhaps the most interesting thing that's popped up in the last couple of weeks is this debate over smart guns. I don't know if you knew, but there were two major events that have happened so far in Las Vegas. One of them was a trade show called the Consumer Electronics Show that happened 2 weeks ago. It was the CES that happens every year. It's the largest tech trade show in the world. And you would think, you know, with one of the largest tech trade shows, you would not have problems finding newfangled pieces of technology for everything. But in fact, despite the fact that there were over 3,600 exhibitors there, there was only one person showing smart gun technology. And remember, that's just a week after President Obama had announced that he wants to really push government into working with the industry to come up with smart guns and come up with technology to help protect people. There's another gun show happening now this week called the SHOT Show, and that among that list of exhibitors, that's 1,600 of them, the people who are running the show can't even think of a single one who has this technology. And so it's a really interesting kind of issue where you have a lot of people who are, you know, kind of, you've got the tech industry doing its thing. It's known for being innovative. You have the president trying to push people to actually start using technology to help possibly protect people with guns. And yet these two aren't coming together, which is really fascinating to me.
Smart gun, obviously like a smartphone. What does this aim for you? Does this pull the butt? I mean, how does a smart gun work? And do we need them?
Well, so it doesn't do your Facebook updates. That's the first thing. But what they do typically is that these smart guns typically have protective measures on them to help you be safe. So, for example, one of them has a fingerprint sensor that will, you have to use your fingerprint to even get to the trigger. Otherwise, it won't work. There's another one that has a wristwatch that you wear that sends a radio signal to the gun. And if the gun doesn't receive that radio signal, it won't fire. So there's a lot of these ideas out there that have already kind of caught their little group of people who are really big fans of them. But the critics of all these technologies say, look, a gun is a hundreds-of-year-old device. We've been able to perfect it to the point where when you pull the trigger, you're almost guaranteed that it'll shoot. And when you include technology, which we've all had crashing phones and computers and all those things, even Twitter was offline earlier today, you can't trust that it'll fire. And so the people who are critics of this really are concerned that you're introducing something that actually makes people less safe when they really need that tool. So it's going to be very interesting to watch how this happens. And again, if you think about where we are today, the tech industry just doesn't seem to have a real answer yet for what the president is asking for.
Were they getting much response at the shows, at the CES show, where people warmed up to this idea or not, Ian?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you only have one person who's showing among 3,600 exhibitors, there's definitely not any warming up happening, right?
No.
And the one guy who was there, he did have a lot of attention from NPR and a bunch of other places, and we at CNET wrote about him, but, you know, he's one, right? If you think it's the largest tech show in the world, and only one person has an answer for smart guns, that's a very underwhelming representation. There were more fridges with technology in them, you know, than there were guns.
That's pretty fascinating
and
strange.
Yeah.
Some good ideas. Ian Schur on the line with us, executive editor at CNET News. It's a Tech Tuesday here on the Bill and Wendy Show. And the internet has chosen who the Grand Ole Party debate winner is. Why don't you explain this?
Sure. So one of the fascinating things that happens is that as the election is heating up, we're really seeing that this is becoming the social media election. Twitter and Facebook are becoming huge parts of how the candidates are not only just reaching out to the people, but also there are more and more people who are political experts who are convinced that the way people react on social media is going to actually translate to the ballot box. And so when we see how all these debates are happening, you know, obviously people are watching in record numbers on television, primarily to see the infighting between Donald Trump and the rest of the field. We're also watching to see how the people are reacting on social media. And so far, Donald Trump, unsurprisingly, has received the most mentions on social media during the debates. And so he represented 38% of all mentions, for example, during the Thursday debate in South Carolina.
And Ian, that's good and bad, right? That's feedback that's both positive and negative. Okay.
There are supporters and detractors, and that's the interesting part is that you know, the research is showing that, you know, just because you're getting a ton of attention does not mean that everyone loves you. And so you know, right now a lot of it is getting your name into people's minds.
Right.
Not everyone even knows who these people are, and they're not even sure who they are. So name recognition is a big deal in this case. And plus or minus, I'm sure you could find a political commentator who would say it doesn't matter whether it's negative or positive. At least they're getting into people's minds. So Trump is at 38% of all the mentions. Senator Ted Cruz was at 22%, and Jeb Bush was 11%. And that, if you think about it, that matches up a little bit with the polling, right? Trump continues to be at the top of the field.
Yeah.
Ted Cruz is coming from behind. It's really fascinating to watch how it's playing out on social media.
Ian, thanks so much. We appreciate it. We hope you have a great rest of the week.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Ian Schur, executive editor over at CNET News. Visit CNET. It's right there on your computer. It's easy to find.
CNET.com.
CNET.com has all your CNET questions and answers.
And WGNRadio.com has podcasts of this very show as well. This show is Bill Left, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN.
How bizarre.
Isn't it, though?
It really is.
I said, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Isn't it? Oh, yes.
Is your plan to be a woman growing up somewhere in England at some point? The way you said in it was very Leedsy of you.
It was.
It was very Leedsy. There's an auto dealership in Canada that's in some trouble, and I'll tell you why, and then you'll nod your head, and you'll go, well, he should be in trouble.
Am I going to do the McCabe nod that we
learned? We learned about
yesterday. For salespeople, you're trying to seal a deal, and you nod, and mm-hmm. it's called the McCabe nod. Again, we still don't really know why, just some guy who invented it,
it's
named McCabe.
It's a subliminal way of making your opponent or adversary or sometimes future teammate agree with you. You're nodding yes, and subliminally they go, everything must be good. That guy's nodding yes, so I'm going to agree with him.
I nod all the time throughout the whole day. So do you. We just nodded together. We were doing tandem nodding right here.
I nodded off. I just fell asleep for a minute, but I'm back. All right, so here's what happened in Canada at an auto dealership. Start nodding because you're going to agree with me. They put, you see, they call the attraction board, and it's one of those boards that has letters so they can put messages like, we're having a sale, come on in, or whatever. All right, so here's what they put on their attraction board at this place in Canada. And, well, I'll read it to you, and then you can make up your own mind. Women are like snowflakes, it said in big letters.
That's true.
They can't drive.
Okay, that's asinine.
Yes, it is.
And because women are like snowflakes and everyone is different, some women are kick-ass behind the wheel and some women suck, just as some men.
Absolutely true. You don't have to sell me on that. I'm 100% in agreement. Your driving skills have nothing at all to do whether or not you're a man or woman. Zero.
It has something to do with how paranoid you are, how nervous you are. You need to drive defensively and you need to control that car. Not being a jerk, mm-hmm. but you need to command control of that car. Mm-hmm. You can't be scared of some... I know some people in my family that might be a little nervous when they're driving.
Who are they? Can you name names?
No.
Are you married to them?
Not immediate family.
In-laws?
I'm not saying anything more.
Say. All right.
But, you know, if somebody, like, they're constantly worried someone's going to turn in their lane. You can't be worried. You just have to be aware of it and have the reflexes to deal with it.
That's why I only drive with Corey Crawford whenever I go anywhere, because I've seen his reflexes, second to none. He's the only person I trust.
That
he's
could
my,
be
he's
bad, though, because I could imagine if someone was going to turn in front of him, he would turn so quickly that the car might overturn.
Right. Butterfly save. Yeah. I have to yell that while he's driving.
And
butterfly
see,
save.
Quick reflex, like too quick may be problematic.
It could be.
He may overturn or something.
Now, let me throw into your list.
But he does have a helmet on.
He always has a helmet on. I'll throw this on your list of things you need to be cognizant of while you're driving. Because now it's 2016 and everybody has a cell phone on their hand at all times, and I've talked about this 1,000 times, everybody's texting while they're driving. On Friday, on my way home from here, I was almost completely home. I was in Rogers Park on my way to Evanston, and there's a cab in front of me who's driving right in the middle of two lanes on Sheridan Road. He's dead center in the middle of two lanes, and he's not trying for one lane or the other. He's just in the middle of it. And I'm honking, and other people are honking because he's going to kill somebody eventually.
Then and I you look can't on, pass him because he's taking up a lane.
Impossible. So I look on the cab, and I don't know that all cabs have this, but a lot of cabs now have a thing that says, how's my driving? Call this number. And I've never done it before because I always go, oh, it's just a bad moment or whatever. But this guy was like this for 5 or 6 minutes. So I get the number, and I have...
While you're driving?
Well, yeah, but I have... hands-free dialing in my Jeep. So I can just, I say call, and then I say the number I want it to call, and it just magically calls it. So this is what I expect to have happen. Tell me if you think this is correct. When you call that number, you think somebody's going to answer the phone, and then you're going to say, I want to complain about cab number 814. I just made that number up. I don't know which cab number it was. And they'll say, well, we'll have him fired. He'll be, he can't
I don't expect
drive
that
a cab
to
anymore.
I expect to get a recording.
I talked to a woman, and here's what, this was her first question. Well, what's the cab driver's name? And I said, I don't know the cab driver's name. I just know the number. And
she thought you may have been in
it. She's upset. I know, but the number's written on the outside of the cab, not on the inside of the cab. So you would think if you're getting calls like this all day, eventually it's going to soak in. It's a motorist who's upset with the way he's driving.
I would think it was someone who had a bad cab ride, and when they get out, they call that number.
I guess. But in my head, like as I'm looking at the number, I'm going, this will be a very fast process. I'll report this guy, and then I'll see some kind of police pull him over and escort him to jail. But it wasn't like that at all. She wants to know his name.
You have such an imagination.
And I don't know his name. So she said, well, where did his ride start from? And I don't know that answer either. I just know where I am and where he is. That's all I know.
And did you explain that? Did
yeah,
you say,
I'm trying to explain
you know what,
it.
Didn't take the cab. I'm just reporting
right.
what I'm seeing.
I tried that. So then she said, well, here's what we'll do. Give me your, she wanted my address and phone number. And they're going to send me forms to fill out. And I said, well, can't we do that now over the phone? That's the purpose of the call. Oh, no, sir. That's not how it works. We'll send you forms in the next 3 to 4 weeks. You send them back to us. Well, by that time,
I'll be... Have you hung up by now?
No, but I'm thinking there's got to be some better process than this.
I would have hung up.
To get this guy off the road, right? I should have hung up.
So are the forms coming to your house?
No, they promoted the guy. He's in charge of that cab company. She said 3 to 4 weeks. She goes, expect to see the forms in 3 to 4 weeks. I go, can I lodge a complaint with you right now over
right,
the phone?
Right, here's the cab number.
No, that's not how it works, sir. We take the complaint, we send you the forms, you fill them out,
oh,
you
God.
Send them back, and then we throw them away. Oh, all right.
All right, she
That'll
didn't
be good.
Say that.
She didn't say that part, but what's going to happen? Nothing's going to happen.
Can Dave jump in?
Sure.
Hi, Dave.
You just, you're picking up using hands-free just blew me out the door. was driving on the tollway at one time. A guy was driving erratic, speeding. There was a commercial truck, a number on the truck, called the number on the truck, and then watched the guy in the truck pick up the phone to answer the phone.
Oh, great. Perfect. What's better than that?
You want to say something, but you know, is the guy going to slam on his brakes?
All right.
If I really drive me off the road, what am I going to do?
Got to tell you, that is the best idea I've ever heard. Thank you, Dave. Be careful out there.
That's not fair.
No, it isn't, but it's funny.
That's not fair.
All right, more information. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
We're good.
Good. If you have a problem with a cab, you dial the 311 number.
That's the number I called.
City Consumer Services. You don't have to give an address and stuff. They do it...
Wait, you didn't
email.
Call? I thought
it was 311. That's the number I called.
Oh, I thought it said if this driver's doing a bad job, call this number,
yeah,
the cab
it says,
company.
How? What was the
how
wording?
How am I driving?
How's my driving or something like that?
How
call
am I
this
driving?
Number. Well, something like that. Antarctica. I don't know. It said, so call this number, and it's 311, which I did hands-free. I'm not breaking the law. And then I got a rigmarole. I don't have time for a rigmarole, Wendy. But that was it. It was 311, and I know
that's
their
the city's number.
Yeah, but why the process of they're going to send me forms? Can't
okay,
she just...
but that's not the cab company.
No.
Oh, okay, I was under
company.
The
because she asked for the driver's name, then she asked for the cab company, and that became a hassle because then I had to try to get over to see what cab company it was.
Thank you, Steve.
Flash
for that
cab,
call.
By the way. It was Flash cab.
All right.
Thank you, Steve.
See, but then they should have how am I driving and then the flash cab number, so you call them.
Wouldn't that be better?
But didn't you know 311 is the City of Chicago non-emergency?
I did, but I didn't know, like, I've never called 311. I didn't know what their jurisdiction was, but I guess that makes sense that
it's
would be what
the
they would do.
It's not the cab company. It's
right.
just, you know, right. your
right.
Better Business Bureau kind of watchdog group.
But they need to do more with that, not just go, we'll send you a form. Because someone, it's going to get lost either to me or back to them. Nothing's going to get done
no.
because of that.
And in that length of time, that's ridiculous. You should be able to file an online complaint
right.
immediately.
Right. Or over the phone. That's easy.
Or over the phone.
Right.
Eddie and Jobo would let you do it.
I know they would. I called Eddie and Jobo. They took down my information.
You should see they're driving. They're terrible.
All right. A quick break. If you want to jump in, we're at 312-981-7200. Back after this, it's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Benjamin Orr is dead, too, from The Cars, who sang this song.
Right, right.
God, there's more rock concerts in heaven now than here on earth.
I guess so. We're talking a little bit about Cars because of an auto dealer. We'll get back to the story. I didn't tell you the rest of the story.
No, because you wanted to complain about a cab driver.
I needed to complain about a cab driver for just a moment. There's a sign at Mellish Motors. This is on Prince Edward Island in Canada. And it says this, and I'm going to warn you, it's hysterically funny. So just be prepared to laugh so hard you can't breathe. Women are like snowflakes. They can't drive, it says there at Mellish Motors.
That's
hysterical.
People
are not reacting well to it. I'll tell you more in just a little bit. There's a couple of calls. We're at 312-981-7200.
Oh, okay. this is Ed. Hi, Ed.
Regis, Kathy Lee, how are you doing today?
I have no idea what you just said, but I heard the how you doing.
Regis and Kathy Lee.
Oh, okay.
How you doing?
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Okay.
What's up?
I'm a professional truck driver now. I have always been taught since day one, my parents, from my high school driver's ed, from everybody who's shown me anything about driving, talked about driving, you take it seriously. Something that everybody does every day, and it just amazes me that people don't get better at it, or
it's
don't
true.
Want to get better at it.
Yeah.
I've raced cars, I've driven cars, trucks. Right now I'm buying an 80,000-pound vehicle that I'm taking down the road, and people think I can stop on a dime, and they ride right next to me where I can't see them, all that stuff, and there's a lot of things that don't surprise me anymore. Right now, my motto is, and I say it's how I taught my daughter, the big thing is assume the person in front of you is going to do something stupid. When they don't, move on to the next person. Assume that
right.
person's going to do something stupid and be prepared for it.
That is some great advice.
Solid advice. So
really
solid.
Really appreciate that.
So here's the reaction that this got. Here's again. This is the sign. Mellish Motors, Prince Edward Island in Canada. They said on their attraction board in front of their dealership, their car dealership, women are like snowflakes. They can't drive. Another local business owner, Chelsea Ling of Peppermint's Pretty, Pepper Cakes Pretty. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that is. Posted a photo of the sign on Facebook with this. I'm very much for businesses doing what they want and not for people saying, oh, they ran a business, they can't do that. But I think there should be common sense of what's hateful and what's funny, she told the CBC. That's one of their big TV networks. Ling also said that she didn't want her sons to see the sign because it's on a major highway. Just because it's normal in society, I don't believe that it's okay, she told the network. But John Mellish, who manages the used car dealership, is not backing down. After receiving complaints, he changed the sign to read, still not backing down. And then he changed it a third time. Attention, drama queens. Auditions for today have been canceled.
Can I tell you something? Can I give people a life lesson?
Please,
here?
What do you got?
All I got to say is if you see something that you don't like this D person who has put this sign up there, then don't go there.
Right.
You putting it on social media and giving him attention is exactly what he wants.
Well,
he has a right to do whatever he wants, and you have a right to shop wherever you want.
Sure,
so
of course.
If you see this and it's like, God, what a jerk.
Right.
Move along. Now he's getting this attention and doing three signs just to get written about again. And now he gets what he wanted.
I know.
Just everybody mind their own business. If somebody's doing something you don't like, just ignore it.
Here's what he just told the CBC. We probably struck a nerve with one or two people out there.
More than one or
that's
two,
what
you
he
big
said.
Lug.
One or two. So be it. That's fair ball, he said. Some people take it the right way, and I love that.
Who takes it the right way? Men.
I would say predominantly men who believe that women aren't as good of a driver. But I know in my lifetime, I can't tell anymore. If something happens on the roadway and there's somebody driving erratically, I never say to myself, is that a man or a woman? I say to myself, are they either drinking or texting or barbecuing in their car when they should be driving?
Yeah, I know, really, you see everything
oh,
nowadays.
God.
We have a little fun thing in our family. Like if we're driving as a family and somebody cuts us off, it's like, I bet it's a guy who's in his mid-50s and he's just big.
You try to guess the profile of the
and
driver.
And it's usually wrong. Like sometimes you'll go, oh, it's a teenager, and it's like a 45-year-old woman.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I had a burrito last night.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know if you can hear it.
There's
but
ghostly noises in the studio.
It's a jackhammer. They're working on the outside of the building.
And I've also told you that I've mastered this thing that my wife likes to refer to as the look, whereas if I pass by somebody who's driving erratically, I can't not just stare at them as if to say, what's wrong with you? Why are you driving that way? But she says the look will someday get you killed. You can't just look at people that way. That's all I do. I don't even flip them off anymore. There was a time where I would drive by and honk and flip them off. I don't do that anymore. I give this look like, really, you're on the same roadway as the rest of us driving that way? Seriously?
I agree with Terry. You can't give the look anymore. Like, we stopped giving the finger to people or rolling down your window and yelling at them. You can't do that because you don't know who's in the next car.
I know.
Now I think, you know, if somebody's being a jerk, just look straight ahead and don't even look at them.
But don't you feel like you need something, like the transaction isn't complete unless you somehow let them know that you're not thrilled with the way
they're
driving?
Well, they're not thrilled with you, because when somebody gives me that look, I give them the look right back.
Oh, come on, you do?
Yeah, because maybe they're doing so. Maybe there's some guy who's in a hurry, who's weaving in and out of traffic, and then I go to give him the look while he's giving me the look because he thinks I slowed him down. Just mind your own business, everybody. Put blinders on and just disregard everybody else's crap.
All right. That's how it is. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back right after the news with a lot more show. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Soothing, isn't it?
Yes, it's Bill and Wendy. It's WNUA. We hope you have a soothing week.
You got to talk like this. You got to talk like Charlie Wojcicki.
I can't talk that way.
You have to be quiet. All our next guest is saying is give his musical piece a chance, a chance to take down ISIS. We've got a man on the line, James Twyman. How are you, James?
I'm very good, thank you.
All right, that was very soothing,
extremely
wonderful music.
Extremely soothing, James. Very soothing.
Well, thank you. We didn't get to the words in the song, but I'm glad the beginning is soothing.
Yeah, it was a long intro. I didn't know if there were lyrics coming up. But now, James Twyman is a New York Times bestselling author. You're a musician, obviously, a filmmaker, inspirational speaker. You're based out of Oregon, and we are now to refer to you as the Troubadour of Peace.
Yes, and you should add that I'm from Chicago.
Oh, cool.
Well, that's cool.
Nice bonus.
When did you leave here?
I left there, oh goodness, I think when I was 32, so 20 years ago. But I went to Loyola and lived in Chicago for many years. And when people ask where I'm from, I always say Chicago.
Nice. You're missing a heat wave right now, James. It's so hot here. I can't stand how hot it is.
All right. So 20 years ago when you left Chicago, the world has changed dramatically in those 20 years. And I'm sorry, never heard of ISIS before. And now that's all we hear. And it's your plan, if I get this right, to take your music and serenade ISIS members and get them to stop terrorizing us?
I would say yes and no. People have the image of me walking into an ISIS-held village with a guitar on my back, and I would not say that is exactly accurate because I'm not completely crazy. I'll begin.
Good to know.
I'll begin by saying that I've done this a number of times where I've gone into countries where wars have raged, from Bosnia to Iraq to many others. And the most important part of it is not so much what I'm doing on the ground, but the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of people behind me, hundreds of thousands of people who have stopped what they're doing in that moment and chosen to send their prayers of peace to that particular situation. And what we have found is that inevitably something shifts. It's actually been scientifically proven now that when massive numbers of people do stop and offer their energy, their prayers, or whatever you want to call them, it does have the power to change things. So, yes, I am going to be actually overlooking several Syrian villages. I'll be with a group of Muslim and Christian and Jewish leaders doing this small concert. But we will be within sight of these ISIS villages. But the most important thing is that there will be hundreds of thousands of people all over the world who are focusing in with us.
And are you going to be streaming this so we can do it from the safe confines of our own living room?
Well, we don't know yet because the place where we're going to be and the exact time at the moment is secret. I mean, we do have some security measures in place. More than likely, we are going to be outside, and it may be difficult to stream it, but we may be able to find some way to do that. So we're working on the logistics now, but whether we do or not, what we're asking people to do at that time, which it will be on February 1st, by the way, we're asking people to simply stop what they're doing for 10 or 15 minutes and just focus in a positive way on what is happening there in that region. And when I say positive, I mean that because obviously so many of us, we feel helpless. We feel like there's nothing that we can do. Also, many of us feel that the situation with almost every Muslim is so dire. I have literally received dozens of death threats since initiating this whole thing, but not from Muslims and Islamic extremists, from very ordinary people who are so completely against doing anything that is a positive outreach to these people. And for me, that this vigil is as much for us as it is for them, to help melt the hearts of the average person here in the United States or around the world who still believes that we should eradicate Islam, which is, you know, it's crazy, but still many people think that. So it's amazing the energy that this vigil has been getting. And I think it's because the ISIS situation is so complicated that we're looking for unusual solutions.
James, go back to the death threats for just a little bit. What are they saying? How are you receiving them? Are you getting emails or people stopping by the house? What are they doing to let you know? What are they doing?
Mainly through Facebook.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've been letting people know about the vigil through Facebook, clearly. And so there have been dozens of people who have been saying that, you know, they're vehemently against this, with very vivid details of what they would like to do or what they hope ISIS will do.
Right.
And what they believe to be the proper attitude against Islam. And what I want to remind them, first of all, these are people who claim to be Christian. And one of the primary messages of Jesus is love your neighbor and do good to those who hate you. That's the path that, you know, that Jesus, you know, took himself.
So this will not deter you. You're not afraid of these death threats. You have a plan, and you're going to stick to the plan. All right.
Well, we do have a plan, and obviously we're going to be as safe as possible. As I said, we're going to be I'm really honored, actually, that this group of Islamic and Christian and Jewish leaders want to come with me. So we're going to keep as safe as possible. I just became a grandparent about 8 months ago.
Congratulations. So
thank you very much. And, you know, one thing that I should mention is a lot of what is going on here does have a link to Chicago, because when I lived in Chicago, I was married. My daughter now is 30. And 10 years ago, my wife, who was living in Evanston at the time, was murdered. She was murdered on Thanksgiving, so just over 10 years ago now. And at that time, I had been going to many of these places like Iraq and Bosnia and many other countries, and my daughter asked me to stop. Clearly,
she was worried. She was worried that she lost her mom. She didn't want to lose her dad, too.
And I agreed to that, understandably. And yet, just a few weeks ago on Thanksgiving, when it was the 10th anniversary of Linda's death, I almost felt as if Linda had a hand in this. It was almost as if she thinking about her inspired me further to do this. And I talked to my daughter, and she agreed as long as I was staying as safe as humanly possible that she would be okay with that. But it was interesting how it kind of came full circle with what happened with Linda there in Evanston.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show that you never know what's going to happen. I mean, one day a loved one is with you, the next day they're not. But I believe that this is a time for us to have courage, and especially in the helpless situation that we feel with what's going on in the Middle East. This is such a small thing, but if people do stop for that 10 or 15 minutes, knowing that there are hundreds of thousands of people who are with them, at least it gives us the feeling that we're contributing in a positive way.
All right. Now, we are talking to James Twyman. He is putting together what he is calling the largest peace prayer vigil in history. Your Facebook page, or do we go to your website to find out when this is going to happen on February 1st?
The best thing would be to go to jamestwyman.com, and then there's a place you can register, and that just allows us to be able to send out an email the day before. So on the 31st of January, we'll send out an email with the exact time, where we're going to be, all of that. So that helps us to really gather the tribe. So just go to jamestwyman.com and get more information. And, of course, Facebook you could also find me on. And we really hope everyone will join us, especially everyone there in Chicago.
James, are you okay on time? We've got more questions for you, but that depends your availability. Okay, good. More with James Twyman in just a little bit. Stick around. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
In the name of Allah, the merciful and the great, praise be to the Lord of all.
You're listening to the mellifluous tones and the wonderful lyrics of James Twyman. And James is a best-selling author, a musician, filmmaker, inspirational speaker. You're now based out of Oregon. You're known as the Troubadour of Peace. My question to you, as you're getting ready for the largest peace prayer vigil in history in a part of Syria, that, I think, is the problem. People have their own God, whether it be Jesus or Allah or whatever, and you're going to sing about this and hope the positive vibes. Maybe, I don't know, maybe ISIS will not. I'm thinking they're going to just come right after you.
I hope not. What do you
think? I mean, aren't you scared of that?
Well, I can't say that I'm frightened. I would say that I'm concerned for our safety, and we're going to do everything we possibly can to remain safe. But the important thing to remember is that the foundation of every religion is peace. And whether you're praying to Allah or to Yahweh or to God, it doesn't really matter because, first of all three of those religions, we're all cousins. We're all from the Abrahamic tradition. And so to sing the peace prayers, for example, that was the Muslim peace prayer that we were just listening to. It reminds us of the foundation of who we are. Now, every religion, whether it be Christian, you know, Judaism or Islam, has extremists. Every religion has people who try to use their religion to force their own agenda, which is not what that religion is about. We see that just as much with Christians as we do with anyone else. Unfortunately, it is endemic with Islam right now. But I think that the path to something more clear is not, there's no real political solution that's going to get us there. There's certainly no military solution. That makes it worse, as we see in Syria and in Iraq. I think that the only real solution would be what I would call a spiritual solution, which means that people like all of us who do, you know, have a true foundation, what these spiritual paths are all about, assert them in some way. So for me to go there to do this concert within eyesight of these villages is an important part of that, because there'll be hundreds of thousands of people who are focusing their prayers of peace at the same time. This is to empower people, really. And I'm certainly not expecting to go and sing a few peace prayers and for ISIS to lay down their weapons. But I do believe that it could be the beginning of an energetic shift if enough people get involved and support this by being with us on February 1. It certainly doesn't hurt, but if it gives people the feeling that they're doing something positive, it could help very much.
James, you must in some way have to clear this through the government, the U.S. government. What does the State Department think about what you're doing?
They're urging you not to go, aren't they?
They are, yeah. I've received a couple of phone calls from the State Department. I mean, clearly going, you know, very far into Syria is very, very dangerous.
Yeah.
But we've actually been working with the State Department to find a way to do this the safest possible. There's no way that they can stop me, clearly. But But I assured them that I have no intention of putting my safety too dramatically at risk. But and they were happy to hear that. But we're doing our best to honor what, you know, the advice that they're giving us, at the same time fulfilling what we believe to be the mission.
And I believe, according to Associated Press, the U.S. State Department have stated that, quote, no part of Syria should be considered safe from violence. And they've
That's
warned
right.
American travelers of the threats of kidnapping and murder at the hands of terrorists in the region. Yet James Twyman is going there on February 1st. You can follow him on his website, jamestwyman.com. TWYMAN.com. You had mentioned you were originally from Chicago, and your wife Linda had been murdered in Evanston in 2005. Have they found anyone? Is this still unsolved?
No. Yes, it remains an unsolved crime, which, you know, it's very frustrating. I mean, we all know the challenges that all Chicagoans have faced. In especially the since then, especially, and as I said before, a tragedy like that it puts it puts my life and all of our lives into a strange perspective. It teaches us the value of honoring the people that we love, because we never know what's going to happen tomorrow. Linda is someone, you know, I thought she was always going to be in my life. My daughter felt the same, and suddenly one day that changed. And as I said before, my daughter asked that I not go to so many war zones, because she didn't want her father to leave. And I certainly have taken that for the last 10 years, especially, in deep consideration. But we've discussed it, and she feels as strong, well, not as strong as I do, but certainly she trusts me in this, and she's behind me. And I know that in some way Linda is behind this as well.
And is that when this troubadour of peace kicked into full effect with you, James, after Linda's death?
No, it was quite some time before that. It was in the first time I ever traveled to a war zone was in 1995. So 10 years before that, I went to Bosnia and Croatia. What had happened was a friend of mine had given me a sheet of paper that had the peace prayers from the 12 major religions, and as I read each one, I just heard this music, and I was able to put all 12 prayers to music in 1 hour. And I felt, you know, people were calling me the peace troubadour. I felt that a peace troubadour should be willing to go to where peace was needed. And at that time, that was in the Balkan region. So I got myself invited and performed the concert in refugee camps and theaters in Sarajevo and many places.
And now your mission is calling you to Syria. Please be safe.
I certainly will. I intend to make it back to Chicago one day very soon, so I will be safe so I can do that.
And let us know how it goes. It's the largest peace prayer vigil in history. His name is James Twyman, and go to his website, jamestwyman.com, T-W-Y-M-A-N. And on February 1st, let's all take 10 to 15 minutes, because you're right, we are sitting here at home in Chicago helpless as to what's going on there. And if we could all put positive vibes and prayer in full force, who knows? Who knows what will work?
Well, I appreciate you helping to get the word out, and hopefully we can chat again very soon.
We hope so, James. Thanks. Be safe.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. That's James Twyman. His website is his name, James, spelled the traditional way, and then T-W-Y-M-A-N, jamestwyman.com. We'll find out what Steve has next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Kim, thanks. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and Wendy. Call us or text us, 312-981-7200. We'd be happy to hear from you.
We would.
It would be nice to hear from you. You just made fun of me, and that's fine. But
which part?
There was a report about an accident on Locust Street, and I got all excited because, as a former fan of All My Children, I know that Locust Street played a very integral role in what happened in Pine Valley.
And all I said was Estelle, and you said Estelle and Donna, and I said, oh, I forgot about Donna, and you said...
Candace Early, that was the actress who played Donna. That's where all the prostitution took place, and the seedier side of Pine Valley was on Locust Street, so I hope that everything's okay over there. Or Dr. Chuck and Benny Sego will have to come and rescue more of the prostitutes.
Remember Benny? Who played him?
There were two Bennies on the show. Vasily something, and I don't remember his last name, but it was Vasily something, played Benny Sago.
And Billy Clyde Tuggle?
Billy Clyde Tuggle was fantastic. That was Matthew Cowles. He died about a year ago. He was married to Christine Baranski.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, because one time at an Emmy Awards presentation, I saw Christine Baranski in the audience, and then next to her was her husband, Matthew Cowles, but I thought it was Billy Clyde Tuggle trying to sneak up and kidnap her during the Emmy telecast. I called the station. I go, please warn Christine Baranski that the evil Billy Clyde Tuggle is behind her.
Vasily Bogazianos.
That's the guy. That's one of the two Benny Sagos.
Greek, I would imagine.
I think so.
He was Benny Sago number two.
Yeah.
Bill, why in the world...
Why would I retain that knowledge?
Why in the world don't you work for Entertainment Weekly or something?
I don't know. I have no idea. And I know this is information that really there's no reason that any of this should stick to my brain at all. I don't know why it does. It doesn't make sense. In the days before IMDb, I'd have friends call me up, like college friends. I'd get a call at like 2 in the morning going... All right, I know you're going to think this is stupid, but Jerry Van Dyke used to be on a show in 1971, and then I would tell them the name of the show.
IMDb stands for Internet Movie Database, but it used to stand for Internet Movie Data Bill.
Right. In the old days, it was just me doing it. 24 hours, I would sit by a phone, and people would call up, and that was it.
I know, you know, despite the fact that we work well together, we are completely different people. Friends would call you about entertainment things.
Mm-hmm.
My friends would call me to see what their symptoms meant they had before
WebMD.
I was WendMD. So look, we both have our specialties. Mine may be a little more helpful to people.
I thought of a service years ago, and I still think that this would work. You know how you're in a situation, sometimes it's a business situation, sometimes it's a family situation. You'll be at some sort of a wedding or a reunion of some sort, and you'll see a guy, and you know that guy, but you don't know that guy's name. I think there should be some sort of a service where you could quickly call a number and either hold up the phone to look at the guy or just say, he's 5'10", he's got like reddish hair, he's kind of got a mustache, a little bit thin, and then they go... Well, that's Tim. And then you know who it is. You can go up to him and go, Tim, how are you? There should be some sort of a service like that who tells you those people that you're like, I know that guy from somewhere. Where do I know that guy from?
You know, they're working on an app now where you can take a picture of the food you're about to eat, and they can maybe tell you if it's spoiled or how old it
is. Is that right?
Right.
That would be great.
So clearly you could do, like, if you just took pictures of all your friends.
Right, and sent them to a database.
You'd have to create your own database.
Yeah, that would be a lot of work getting the database together. Can't you just go through your yearbook before a reunion?
It's not always somebody like that. You know how sometimes you'll be downtown and you'll see somebody out of context? It'll be like one of your son's teachers. And you didn't think Mrs. Bremer would be there, but you're walking down the street and there's Mrs.
Right.
Bremer. And you're like, I know that lady from somewhere. Where do I know her from? This would say it's Mrs. Bremer. You know her because she's your son's teacher.
I have something that could work for you, but not as broadly.
How does it work?
There were times that I would run into parents of kids my kids have gone to school with.
Yeah.
And you don't see them on a regular basis, so you kind of forget their names.
Right.
So I'd put the kid's name in my contacts and then their parents' name. So when I go, oh, that's Frank's mom,
right,
I will look in my contacts under Frank because I always remember the kid's name.
That's very smart.
And then I'll go, oh, Jenny, how's it going?
That's very smart.
But don't do what I did, because the last time I did that, I had to tell the woman about my plan.
You did?
Yes.
How did she react to that?
She said, yeah, sometimes I forget people's names too.
Oh. Well, that was,
she hadn't forgotten
that was honest.
Mine, but
that was honest.
I completely forgot her name, so I looked up her son's name on my contacts, and right away, bing.
So smart.
Just don't leave the second part of it out. I'm too honest.
Have you been in situations where you meet somebody, and then in your head you go, I will never see this person again? So even though you know their name for the duration of when you're with them,
right.
I was at a Christmas party years ago with somebody, and I talked to this guy quite a bit at the party, but then in my head it's like, well, I won't need to retain the knowledge of him because I'll never see him again until I ran into him last summer. And he remembered everything that we talked, and I did too, but the name just wasn't there.
All right. But, you know, we're on the radio every day, so it's a little easier remembering our names.
I guess. Although that never came up during our conversation. That wasn't it at all. He didn't.
What did you talk to him about?
Bass fishing.
Was it Johnny B or Babe Winkleman?
I don't remember.
All right. You are going to run into these people again, and there should be an app for it.
Yeah.
Kevin, you have an incident or an idea or a past experience?
Yes, but from what you just said, I can't remember what your name is, lady. Oh,
it's Wendy and Bill.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it is.
That's better.
Thank you. And Wendy, don't lose your contact phone stuff. But Bill,
it's a good idea, isn't
earlier,
it?
Yeah, and you guys are my two bestest friends on the radio.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, so what you were talking about with people calling you up at crazy hours about what do you know about this, it reminds me of that Seinfeld episode where Kramer takes over as the movie phone guy.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that.
And he has looking through the paper, and he has no idea, and he has people punching things in on the phone. He says, well, why don't you just tell me what movie you're looking for?
Yes, I remember that, too. Can I tell you, that is just the perfect nightcap to any night when you just need some mindless television before you go to bed.
Half an hour of Seinfeld?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely agree. You guys are the best. Thank you very much. And Kevin is great.
Well, thank you on
Thanks,
all counts.
Kevin.
He mean himself or our Kevin?
I think he meant himself.
All right. No, he definitely meant me.
All right.
All right. And Tom has a comment, too. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Bill and Wendy. Loving on your show.
Thank you, Tom.
Loving on you.
Bill, I understand your theory about the name recognition, and a name is the most important thing for every person. They'd love to hear it.
Sure.
But if you have this app, then it makes the fact that you knew their name meaningless and insignificant. There are other ways to remember their name.
And
it does. I'm not going to say it
but
doesn't.
But isn't
it
better to know their name than to go, "Hey, buddy. Hey, woman."
Well, no, not if they know that you knew their name, because you could just ring it up somewhere.
Yeah, it does. It demystifies it a little bit somehow. It's not as special. I give in to that. That's true.
Right. Okay, but there is a way to do it, and this is what I practiced. I used to be a high school teacher, and damn it, that was important to know every kid's name.
Sure.
I thought they were special, and I was able to memorize it, but because that's when I was younger. You know, I could just do the, you know, make a like a mnemonic expression with their name.
Yeah.
But as I've grown older, all you have to do is write the name down. And let's say you go into a video store and you're renting movies all the time. You just write that person's name down, and so when you go in there, you recognize it, and pretty soon you'll know it. You don't have to have that young brain where you connect it with a mnemonic phrase that would always remind you of their name. And boy, does that work!
Although Tom,
works better than the nod. Than McCabe nod.
Oh, which we learned about yesterday. Tom,
yes.
But here's the thing, and it is very important for a teacher to know a kid's name, because, man, that does make you feel like you stand out from the other students. However, Tom, say that you're at the grocery store 10 years later and that kid comes up. You hadn't seen him in 10 years. You're not going to remember their name.
No, you're not. But you don't want to call on the phone and say, you know, try to figure it out. But no, you're right. Yeah, you don't know your name. So the first thing to do is to say, "Hey, my name is Tom."
I do
remember
that too.
You, and you say, "My name is Tom," and then they say, "Okay, my name is Wendy."
They don't always do that though, because if I go, "Hey, you know, Wendy Snyder," and they go, "I know your name,"
right,
and then they don't offer it up,
right,
and then you got to go. And
you're caught. And you'd say, never say the phrase, though. Never say this phrase: "I remember faces but not names," because that is so lame.
Yeah.
Everybody remembers faces. But you can learn the name just by writing it down. It's weird. In my car, I carry around, grocery store, wherever I go, I have these names of people. I know everybody's name. It's just phenomenal.
That's valuable. It really is. There's no question about it. Thank you, Mark. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Appreciate it.
We should do that.
Now, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I will give you a surefire way to know if somebody is pretending to know who you are and they don't. Because men have one and women have one, and they're very different from each other. All right, we'll come back. We'll talk about this and other topics. We're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Billy!
Shirley.
Let's do Chuck.
Chuck. Well, I see what you're doing.
I almost got you in trouble. We're talking about names and remembering people's names and little tricks to either remember their name or not. This is how you can tell if somebody pretends to know your name, but they do not know your name. This is how you can always tell. And it's different between men and women. Because men have a specific phrase that they say, and women have a specific phrase that they say.
What's up?
What's up is the one that most men and women never say. if a guy ever says this, if he sees you somewhere and points and goes, there he is, he does not know your name.
I think if you say anything to the person other than their name,
then they
don't know
your name. But specifically, and I know this for a fact, I used to work with this guy, Dennis, who didn't remember anybody's name. I remember Dennis's name, but I can't tell you how many times he would do that. He would see a guy, maybe it was his brother or his next door neighbor. There he is. As if to say, I was just talking about you. Really? Then what's my name? I don't know. I just know you're there.
May I speak in defense of Dennis and others?
Yes.
Because I'm one of those people.
Yes.
I cannot.
Do you say there he is, though?
No.
Steve,
you don't do that.
I will say something other than if I don't know their name.
He still calls me Sport.
Hey, buddy. Hey, Sport. No, well, I mean, I'll say buddy without, even if I do know their names. But there are a lot of times when I go up to someone, or it takes me a while. It just does. It's just a hole in my brain.
I know.
I am
terrible with names. Terrible.
Well, you have one that's like buddy, though. What's the one I've heard
you use?
Hey,
woman.
Hey, woman. Sometimes it's a guy, and the guy's like, what's with
this? Well, no, I'm very careful. If it's a guy, I'm like, how you been? It's just so obvious. If you don't say their name, like if they say, hi, Wendy, and I say anything that's not inclusive of their name,
right,
they know I don't remember it.
Do you ever do the name that could be anybody's name? It's like the TF on a true-false test where you go, hey, Ryan, how are you? What did you call me?
No,
Robin, Aaron, Morning. What did you say? I don't
Mr.
know what name
Man
that is.
Friend
Now, the woman's version of hey you is...
It wasn't hey you. It was there he is.
There he is the guy's version. Okay. Women will go, hey you. And that just means, I know you, but I don't know what your name is. Hey you. Because why would you say
if you knew
the person's name?
Hey you.
it's like a commercial for soap or something. Hey you, you could use a bar of soap.
Well, so what do you do?
Everyone wears a name tag from now on.
I am so into that. Hello,
everybody must wear a name tag.
Yeah, but knowing you, you would put the wrong name on there just to mess people up. So they would go, hey, Frederick.
Hey, Dr. Bartholomew, that's not your name.
You'd have to pause so I can put my reading glasses on and read the tag.
Shouldn't you just come right out and admit it? Because I'm going to do that from now
you
on.
You should, but then the person's feelings are going to be hurt.
Yeah, and I take issue with the phrase or the term admit it, because really, there are people I can come up to, I will know everything about them, the last conversation by syllable.
Just not the name?
But the name isn't there.
I don't
feel like I should admit anything. It's not like I don't care. It's not like I care about the person less.
Right, it's just the name.
I don't like to make anyone upset.
Right.
And it really makes me feel like a heel.
To not remember.
You're upsetting me right now.
But do you do the thing with Jim? I think every couple has this figured out where
except tell Jim this.
There's a look that you give your mate as if to say, here's somebody I'm having a conversation with and I should know their name, but I don't. So please introduce yourself so that they will say their name to you, right? You do that, right?
We have a thing. If I don't immediately say, hey, Jim, this is Bill.
Then
he knows to go, I'm Jim, by the way.
Right.
And then they go, oh, hi, I'm Bill.
Yeah. Right.
I know it's weird. I forget your name. I see you every day. I see you more than my husband.
We've worked together for years and you don't remember mine. That's weird.
But that's just a given.
Right.
Like, I don't even have to give a look. If I don't introduce Jim to the person I'm talking to, then he knows to go, I'm her husband, Jim, by the way.
That's smart. That's a smart move. That's one of the best reasons to get married, in my opinion.
That's the only reason.
It's not the only reason. Is it the only reason?
And if your car needs work.
Yeah, okay, there's the other one. Right. There's two good reasons right there.
All right. We have to take a break. Then we're going to do some news with Scott Bertrand. And
read his name tag. It says Steve
Look
Bertrand.
At his face. He just gets so irritated with me. Wait in line, by the way. After news, we're going to talk tennis.
It's the tennis scandal that is rocking the sports world. It's not good news. We'll talk to John Templin, who writes for BuzzFeed. He's one of the people who broke the story, and that's coming up in just a little bit. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thanks so much. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder with you. Some startling news.
Wait, what is this song?
Anna Kournikova.
That's the Anna Kournikova song.
I love it.
Some startling news from BuzzFeed. John Templer is one of the reporters who reported on this, and the sports world is shocked. It turns out a lot of tennis players, some of the world's greatest tennis players, may be on the take. We'll get the full story right now from John Templin. Hi, John. How are you?
Good. How are you?
John, well, I'm great. First, before anything else.
I'm appalled.
Wendy's appalled, by the way. You should know this. I'm a huge tennis fanatic. I play tennis. I watch tennis. I eat, drink, and breathe tennis. And when I saw this the other night, I saw your story there on BuzzFeed. It made me sick to my stomach. Share some of the details. What do we know right now is going on in the world of tennis?
Well, part of it is based on the 2008 report that came out that said that, it was focused on one match between Nikolai Davidenko and Martin Vassallo Arguello. But as the investigators looked at that one match, they found three syndicates in Russia, Northern Italy, and Sicily that had been fixing other matches during that time. And since then, it's continued to be a problem in tennis. And people have highlighted, especially the gambling houses and watchdog gambling groups, that there are issues with tennis results and that some of them look very suspicious, either in their odds or in how things are moving pre-match. And so we've actually been talking to a number of places, and from all the information we gathered, we found that there were basically 16 players that at one point or another were ranked in the top 50 in the world that had been flagged by all of these different organizations.
So that is, if my math is correct, that's a third of the world's top players, 16 out of 50. A third of them could potentially have been on the take at some point.
Well, they're not all currently ranked in the top 50, so that's worth noting. But they're all players that were very high ranked at one point or another. Yes, and it includes a Grand Slam champion and other high level players.
So, how would this go down exactly? How would they be approached by these gambling syndicates to possibly throw a match? And then, how much money would have been offered?
Yeah, well, it really depends. And there's been some interesting things said by the players now at the Australian Open, where, in fact, Novak Djokovic actually spoke about how one of his support personnel were approached at one point, and he was offered, I think he said, something like $200,000 to fix a match. And that's on the high end of what we've heard from other people, but they're approached via social media, they're approached via text messaging. And the players are offered money to lose a set or to lose a match. And kind of once the bettor knows that, they're able to go put more money on it than what they're paying the player and make money.
And these are names that, see, I don't pay attention to tennis at all. And I played it in high school. And I know some of the big names, mm-hmm. Anna Kournikova, for instance, mm-hmm. and the Williams sisters. Mm-hmm. But now are these people that we that don't follow tennis would know?
Well, I can't really say too much about the players because we've made the decision not to name any of them.
But that list was at some point made available to you, John, right? You saw the names yourself, right?
Yes, we've seen all the names, yes. Right. And there are players that are known for sure. There are also players who are lower down the rankings that maybe the casual fan wouldn't know.
Okay, and when you say lower down the ranks a little bit, that's at first what I thought, like you kind of have to be a Richie to play tennis, so why would they need to do this for more money? But it varies, doesn't it? I mean, lower end of the rank, they're not making a lot of money.
Well, that's exactly right. Especially in either the once you get out of the top level, the upper echelon of tennis, it's hard to make as much money as you do with those top players. And it costs a lot. You're flying around the world. You need coaches. You need training. It's an expensive sport to play. So you can see where players maybe aren't making quite enough playing, they might be tempted to do something like this.
John, why the decision to not publish their names?
Yeah, it's a kind of a twofold thing. In most cases in our story, there isn't necessarily definitive proof of match fixing. There's very suspicious trends that gamblers and other people have reported to the Tennis Integrity Unit, who's in charge of policing this in tennis. And we didn't want to tar someone with that accusation if we couldn't necessarily prove it with, say, bank statements or telephone records, which are things they can request. And the other larger issue is that we wanted to just point out the fact that this exists in tennis and that tennis authorities don't seem to be doing enough to combat it. And we thought that showing the scope of the problem, the fact that there are these 16 top-ranked players that we've been shown with that have at least 70 names on it, things like that seem to point to the larger problem in tennis instead of naming one player and tarring them with this entire issue.
We've got John Templin on the line with us, a data reporter for BuzzFeed News based in New York, and co-wrote this article that Bill had brought forward to us, The Tennis Racket. Now, what's going to happen now that this has been reported? You're not naming names, so no one's being accused, but what is going to happen with the Tennis Association now?
Well, we're not sure yet. When the report first came out, the tennis authorities obviously denied that they had ever suppressed evidence, and they've been saying that they're working as vigilantly as possible to combat the problem of match fixing. And we'll see, I think, what happens now that this problem has been brought to light. It's been really interesting to watch the coverage at the Australian Open as players have spoken about their experiences, and I think that's kind of at least put a face on how this happens, and so people are more aware of it now. And I think that was a big part of what we wanted to highlight with the article.
John, when they say that they were approached, when various players have been approached, you mentioned various syndicates, gambling syndicates around the world. Was it happening here in the United States, or was it just overseas?
I haven't seen any evidence about the United States in particular. As you know, gambling rules in the United States are pretty tricky, so
yeah.
It's not as pervasive, and maybe that's why. But in the evidence we've uncovered in the last year or so when we've been working on it, I haven't seen anything about that specifically.
But you have to admit, of all the sports that are out there, I would say tennis and probably golf and maybe boxing, those would be the easiest sports to fix, because if you were trying to fix a basketball game, a hockey game, football, baseball, you'd have to get several key guys on a team. But with those sports, they're individual sports. You talk to one guy, you flash some money at him, that would seem like an easy fix, wouldn't it?
Yeah, tennis is particularly vulnerable to match fixing because it's an international game, because there are tournaments being played by, you know, an Australian player in Poland or something like that, and then it's being watched by authorities in, Britain, and they're betting on markets that are in Italy or the Netherlands or something like that. I mean, it just becomes very complicated in terms of jurisdiction, and also you just need one player. So both of those things kind of contribute to the overall problem.
All right. John, I want to go on the record as telling you no one has ever approached me to try to fix a match ever. Just so you
That's
know.
That's because you're a good player.
Well, thank you.
John, do you play tennis at all?
I do not. If you looked at my other article on BuzzFeed, you might have seen that.
Just not a fan of the game. It's not for everybody. We understand. It's not for everybody. That's fine.
Well, no. I didn't see your other article.
So we also did an article just specifically about my data analysis, and there are some gifs of me playing tennis in it as well, just to liven it up. And,
oh, I can't wait to see that now.
People go check that out.
We're anxious to.
I got to tell you, BuzzFeed is so hip and happening with the lists and the news and the trending stuff and all the different categories. Really a cool thing you got going on there at BuzzFeed, and I can't wait to watch you try and play tennis. Maybe I should play you, John, because I'm not a tennis player. Bill would kick both of our butts.
That'd be fun. That would be a lot of fun. John, a great job on this.
Well, thank you very much.
Really appreciate it. It's John Templin from BuzzFeed. Again, the article is called The Tennis Racket. It's still available up there on BuzzFeed. Take a look and decide for yourself. But it really did shock a lot of people in the sports world over the weekend. It really did. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
All right. We'll take a quick break, and then more after this. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
All right. If you've heard the news, we have lost another one in the world of rock and roll. Still mourning the death of David Bowie. That happened last week.
Mm-hmm.
Over the weekend, right?
Yeah, I think, wasn't it? Sunday into Monday or Monday into Tuesday last week?
And then he died of cancer at the age of 69. And then we have lost Glenn Frey from the Eagles, who... It was not cancer. It was kind of a bunch of different things. He had had rheumatoid arthritis, ulcerative colitis, and then developed pneumonia. Bob Seger, rock and roll legend from Michigan, is speaking out saying that Glenn Frey had been in the hospital since November with some of these issues. And now Don Henley has written a touching tribute to his friend following the news of Glenn Frey's passing. This from RollingStone.com. And Don Henley is pretty much known to be a crotchety guy.
Yeah.
And he put, Glenn was the one who started it all. He was the spark plug, the man with the plan. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of popular music and a work ethic that wouldn't quit. He was funny, bullheaded, mercurial, generous, deeply talented, and driven. Glenn Frey died on Monday from complications from rheumatoid arthritis, acute ulcerative colitis, and pneumonia, according to a statement from the Eagles. Henley wrote that the band members are still processing the death. Quote, we are all in a state of shock, disbelief, and profound sorrow, he wrote. And we brought our two-year History of the Eagles tour to a triumphant close at the end of July, and now he's gone. And he says, I'm not sure I believe in fate, but I know that crossing paths with Glenn Lewis Frey in 1970 changed my life forever. It eventually had an impact on the lives of millions of other people all over the planet. It will be very strange going forward in a world without him in it. But I will be grateful every day that he was in my life. Now, didn't Linda Ronstadt put these guys together?
I know that they played backup for Linda Ronstadt and at some point approached her and said, hey, as much as we love working with you, we want to try to strike out on our own and play on our own. And she gave them her blessing, which was, I guess, a very, very good move for them. I've heard, and this is a pretty solid argument, I'm trying to remember where I heard this, it wasn't long ago, that you could easily make the argument that they should be in the top 10 bands of all time.
Oh, absolutely.
I think so, yeah.
I mean, when you think of the early California rock, Desperado, all these, I mean, they were California rock.
Yeah.
And you know who we should talk to is Henry Diltz, that guy who put to, the photographer who did all these album covers, because he had some great stories with the Eagles and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Not young. Not Neil Young, I don't think. But it was pretty amazing what they did. Henley also noted that Glenn Frey, quote, loved his wife and kids more than anything, signed off by addressing the guitarist and singer, rest in peace, my brother. You did what you set out to do, and then some. And it's funny he mentions the brother aspect of it, because they were like brothers. They were bandmates, and with family comes fighting.
Right.
And they did disagree and butt heads on a lot of things.
I've never been in a band, but my guess is everybody
has. You had
has.
That band for a while.
Which band?
Not quite as good as Ezra.
Right. That was a band that I was in for a long time. Not quite as good as Ezra. I try my best to forget about it,
no.
But I can't forget about it. But you have to think creative differences show themselves pretty much on a daily basis, because musicians have this way of wanting to do things. They have a certain
vision.
Sound in their head, and everybody's a little bit different. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So I can certainly see where guys like that would clash a bit.
There's a funny story that Joe Walsh has told on the air so many times. It was something to the effect that on Hotel California, which is, you know, when Joe Walsh hooked up with the Eagles, there's a solo in Hotel California, and Don Henley, Joe Walsh was laying down the track, and Henley said, I think you could do better. I'm going to go out to lunch. Why don't you do it again? And Joe Walsh didn't do anything and left it the same. And Henley came back and said, now that's what I'm talking about.
That's perfect.
That's such a funny story. But that's, musicians have a vision, and they want to make it work that way. And, you know, with all those people coming together with their ideas, of course there's going to be disagreements.
Sure.
But I can't believe how many I know that solo career for Glenn Frey, he did that Smuggler's Blues.
Right.
Which was featured on a Miami Vice episode. He was in that.
He was. For some reason, and I'm trying to find it on Internet Movie Database exactly how many episodes, but I seem to remember him showing up in more than one episode of Miami Vice. And if you're under the age of 30 and don't understand the impact of that show. It's really weird because on paper, that show doesn't hold up, but it was an enjoyable Friday night to watch Miami Vice, and they would get guest stars like Glenn Frey to show up and sometimes play a good guy and sometimes play a bad guy.
And it was Miami, so there was definitely smugglers that they were trying to get.
Right.
And that was the theme to the song of that week's show.
Right.
And, you know, there's Glenn Frey, and he was built. He had a nice bod.
He did.
And he's wearing the, you know, the T-shirt with the suit.
Right.
And the no socks.
That's what they did back then.
It totally was a fashion statement.
He's now, I won't go through his entire list of credits, but you forget, because he was a musician primarily, how many times he did show up on episodic television and actually wrote a couple of episodes for some shows, a couple shows that I've never heard of. But he was on The Sopranos for an episode or two. He was in the movie The Big Lebowski. He was on an episode of Seinfeld, an episode of Simpsons. Now, some he played himself in, but not all. He was in the movie Thelma and Louise. He was in the movie Ghostbusters 2.
I forget about all this. He was on an episode of The X-Files, too.
Yeah, yeah. South Park, billed
who
only
wasn't
as performer.
On South Park?
Yeah, they've had a, like Simpsons over the years, they've had several.
Except one of the cartoons is funny.
Right.
South Park, God, when that just came out, boy, I loved it. And then it's like, what happened?
I don't know.
They got rid of Mr. Hankey,
and then it fell apart.
Yeah.
That's all it was. Now, it says here he was on High Chaparral, but that can't be right.
Was there
he would
a
have been maybe, because High Chaparral was on in the early 60s, and that doesn't make sense. So I don't think that one's right. That one doesn't sound right to me. He was in the movie The 70s. There's a bunch of them. The names are just kind of familiar. He sat in with the Mystery Science Theater 3000 guys for 5 different episodes, so that's pretty impressive. Was on the TV show. Now this is too early for him to have been on it, but Sergeant Bilko, unless there was a remake of that, but that he would have been like one when Sergeant Bilko was on. So I don't think that one's right either. Did I say Baywatch? He was in Baywatch for a couple of episodes. He really did. He showed up kind of all over the place in movies and television.
And I'm wondering if he's the eagle that you think of who worked out. There was somebody who had a health club commercial, you were saying.
I don't remember if it was Glenn Frey or if it was Don Henley. But
wasn't
one
Don
of the
Henley.
Guys.
That guy doesn't work out.
It hadn't been Glenn Frey
him?
Then. One of the guys on the Eagles was in a couple of health club commercials. I want to say Bally's, but I could be wrong. But I remember for like a year or a year and a half, you saw a guy, and the gist of it was, I used to be a hard rocker, and now I'm taking care of myself, and I'm at this health club. And it was, you know, if you were a kid watching that, you go, wow, a guy like that, who was a rocker. Now he's look at how good he looks. So it was kind of effective.
Did you mention Jerry Maguire? He was in that movie.
No, I didn't see that.
A listener, 630, says that. And then 331, and this is true. Notice how much Don Henley talks about himself in his tribute to Glenn Frey.
Yeah.
Henley's kind of been known for that.
I
don't know him personally, but... he's been known for that.
I know.
Brings it back to him.
Sometimes he does.
Well, it's very sad. He was 67, just getting over the David Bowie stuff. Then, of course, the drummer for Mötley Hoople, Dale. Oh, God, I can't remember his name again.
I don't remember his name either. I'm sorry. I'd help you out, but I don't.
I don't remember it right now, but I'm sorry, drummer for Mötley Hoople. But this is crazy. Kanye West is now recording a David Bowie tribute album. The torch has been passed to him, and he's going to take it.
I'm also seeing now online, and I forgot about this. I saw the movie Joy last week. That's the Jennifer Lawrence movie about the woman who invents a mop. One of Glenn Frey's songs is featured prominently in that movie. I totally forgot about that. I Did It for Love is in there. You get to hear him singing in the movie on the soundtrack, too. So he really, even though... his heyday may have been a couple of years ago, he was still kind of still part of the fabric. I mean, he's still showing up on soundtracks and TV shows.
And Dale Griffin, drummer for Mötley Hoople, dies at 67. They did that, of course, famous for All the Young Dudes, written by David Bowie, presented to Mötley Hoople by David Bowie. David Bowie sings background with Ian Hunter on that song, and that is a weird full circle.
Yeah, it is. It really is. All right, we'll take a quick break. We've got news. Steve will give you the news, and then a lot more show coming your way. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN. Very quickly, before anything else, we wish nothing but good luck to the Chicago Blackhawks tonight as they play the Nashville Predators. If they win, they will have won 12 straight games, a franchise record. The Blackhawks have been around since the 1600s. This is the longest winning streak they've ever had. Boy, I hope they do it. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. You know, it's pretty fun now that I'm a huge Blackhawks fan and I can throw down with information.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a bar on Friday night and there was a game and we were going for game number 10 at that point.
Right.
And I was just trying to sneak in to get a beer and some gentleman said to me, here, you can sneak right in here. And I said, oh, Hawks game. Yes, we're up 2-1. And he said, you know, Patrick Kane got the first two. And I said, maybe he'll get a hat trick. And he just kind of looked at me. And then I got my beer. And then I said, hopefully we get 10 in a row here. Good luck. And he just looked at me like, wow.
He was impressed by your vast knowledge of Blackhawks.
I felt very cool for the first time in my life.
Didn't it throw you when Patrick Kane got the hat trick the other night? It was the first of his career. I would have been positive by this time he had other three-goal games, but it never happened before.
I thought so, too.
It had happened in the playoffs.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, two times. Vancouver and L.A. he got.
So just not in the regular season.
All right, but here's the, you know, and I'm going to look it up because I don't really know, and I'm sorry.
That's right.
Why is it called a hat trick? I know it's been on a Hawktionary, or now it's called Hawkopedia, which I liked Hawktionary better.
Yeah.
Because Hawkopedia is always, I mean, Wikipedia is always wrong, but I guess that's the hipper thing.
It's called a hat trick because it rhymes with Patrick, which is his name.
Yeah, for him. But what if his name is not Patrick, who gets
his
a
name
hat
be?
Trick?
Give me his name and I'll tell you what they would call it.
Marion.
They would call that a Barian. If three goals is a Barian.
Barian Enema.
Yeah. No, I don't think they would call it that.
I mean, I just don't understand that.
Would you agree that he has had, if you look at athletes in our lifetime, this would be, for lack of a better term, the most interesting year an athlete has had? It started out extremely controversial with everything that went on.
Which nothing was proved, by the way, people who are still saying, oh, he just got away with it. Really? Because there was nothing filed.
But for a lot of people to have that much adversity in your life, you think, well, that's certainly going to affect this guy's game. Look at all that's going on. How in the world can he focus on hockey with all that's going on? And he's having a career, not just a career year for him, but one of the best NHL seasons anyone's ever had.
In my humble opinion, and I don't have to say humble, but I just like going, I-M-H-O, as people put.
I-M-H-O.
In my humble opinion.
Oh. Is that what that means? I see that sometimes, and I don't know what that means. Now I do.
Are you kidding me?
Now I know what that means.
All right.
I never did either. I always thought it was honest, in my honest opinion.
I had no idea what that meant until just now, and I see it all the time.
That doesn't surprise me. Kevin, I'm shocked.
Well, and then there's FTW, which for a long time I was way off.
Fare thee well.
No, it's for the win, but I thought it was something very negative for a long time.
What did you, can you say what you thought it was?
No, I think the F word,
I've told you this, and this is embarrassing, but I don't care. There was a website I used to visit that had different kinds of games, and I played a game that was a billiards game. I would play it all the time, and you could taunt the person you were playing computer pool against. You know, you could say things to them, they could say things to you. And a lot of times when I would jump on there, the first thing they would put is ASL, which I thought meant that they were swearing at me.
Oh, like a shortened version of...
Yeah, but it means age, sex, location. They wanted to know how old I was and where I was.
What do they care?
I don't know. I don't know what's in it for them to know that.
So your age is 12.
Right.
Sex, occasionally.
I wouldn't mind it more often. And put that in there.
Location on my computer.
Right. Duh. I'm playing you on the computer. Where'd you think I was? Come on.
God, people have fun with you.
I was sure they were swearing at me. I stopped playing for a while because I'm like, people at this website are so mean. All I want to do is play computer pool against people and they're swearing at me. They wanted to know more about me so they could swear at me.
I wouldn't have known ASL. That's so funny. But anyway, in my humble opinion with Patrick Kane, the reason he could focus so well on Blackhawks hockey in this game is because he wasn't worried about the outcome. He said he was innocent from day one. If there was any doubt, he would be freaking out.
But even with that, if you were him, wouldn't your mind be kind of consumed with what was going on
off
the ice? Not
if I was innocent, because I would say, you know what? The truth will prevail.
I was so afraid I was afraid that things would not turn out as well as they would on the ice and off the ice, but it's been a banner year for him. he really has just been amazing. Is this right? Is this stat right? There's only been 6 or 7 games all season long that he's not had a point in. Is that right?
I don't know.
That's phenomenal.
I read he has like as many multi-point games as he does 0-point games,
right,
which is like 7 or something
right,
crazy like that.
Right.
All right. Well, a definition of a hat trick, according to Merriam-Webster, one, the retiring of 3 batsmen with 3 consecutive balls by a bowler in cricket. That's not the
that
one I want.
To this.
2, the scoring of 3 goals in 1 game as of hockey or soccer by a single player.
All right.
The origin, probably from the former practice of rewarding the feat with the gift of a hat, first known use in 1877.
Wait. Go back on that one just a little bit. The rewarding of...
Someone gave you a hat for getting 3 goals, but we may have the real story. Uh-oh. Who is this? Craig?
I think they left.
Oh, didn't we? Kevin, thanks. We don't have a caller. We did have a caller. I need to know the origin. Because that, I mean, probably from the former practice of rewarding the feat with the gift of a hat.
So at some point in professional hockey, if a guy scored 3 goals in a game, someone would present them with a new hat? That doesn't seem like much incentive. A top hat? A bowler?
A baseball cap? A
sombrero?
Oh, and 920, it's sad Chicagoans only have hockey to brag about. I'll take whatever we can get.
You know, I was thinking the other day, with the way that we have so many brutal winters, it really has been the Blackhawks the past couple of years that have gotten us through the winter, because you have something to enjoy every couple of days, despite the fact that it's -6 outside. You can watch the Hawks for a few hours and forget about it. Watch a bunch of guys on ice and not have to think about the ice that's outside. Congratulations, Wendy. You have scored 3 goals in a game. Please accept my hat. That was a thing for a while in the NHL?
I need somebody to explain that. And then, fun fact, a lot of people think the Blackhawks were named after the Indian tribe. It was actually the Indian tribe that was named after the hockey team. I thought that it was part of a battalion. There was a Blackhawk battalion. I have to find
really?
More information on this. One of my cousins on my dad's side of the family did... Some family tree.
Like genealogy
snooping.
Or something?
Yes.
Yeah.
She really went into it, and there was a Black Hawk battalion or something that my great grandfather was in.
When would this have been?
I don't know, but I have to do some more information or some research work, because somebody said that it was. I remember seeing it. It was kind of interesting.
Huh. All right.
And someone said, you got a beer and then went off driving. No, I was at a bar, I got a beer, and then went to watch the show.
Right.
And I wasn't watching the Blackhawks game because there were teenagers singing, doing a Queen tribute.
That's what we all imagined was the story.
All right, we have a hat trick story. Can we take a break and
yeah.
then find out the whole backstory on this? Because it's driving me nuts.
Yep, some people
what
know
kind
it.
Of hat?
I don't know. It doesn't seem like that would make a guy try harder in an NHL game, but we could be wrong.
I got a hat coming in.
312-981-7200. We'll find out why hat tricks are called hat tricks. That's coming up next with Bill and Wendy on WGN. Patrick Kane got his first NHL hat trick the other night, much to our shock. We thought he'd been doing it all along, but no, he's done it a couple times in the playoffs, but never in a regular season contest. So why is a hat trick called a hat trick?
Well, you said it because his name was Patrick.
That's how it should be. Your accomplishment should match your should rhyme with your name. That's what I'm trying. I just talked to Gary Bettman from the NHL. He said he just hung up, actually. He didn't say anything.
Hi, Ken. How are you?
Hi. Good. How are you guys doing?
Excellent.
These guys are good. What's about you? Got any sausage?
I have the answer for you.
All right,
what is it?
I may be showing my age a little bit. Back when there were the original 6 teams in the hockey?
Yes.
Okay, remember that?
Yes.
Now, for some back then, players were much better. Scores were like 2-1, 1-0, things like that. But now we got 32 teams and lesser quality players. So back then, when you had 6 teams only, when somebody got 3 goals in a game, guys, we used to wear hats all the time back in the 40s and 50s,
sure.
and 60s.
Right, they like top hats, dress hats, because people dressed up to go to the games.
And there were a lot of magicians back then, so a lot of top hats.
Everybody would throw their hats on the ice, and they'd have to go out there and scoop them all up.
But that has remained the same. I mean, they did that then, they do that now. It was rarer to get a hat trick then. Also, the goal is larger now. It used to be a lot smaller, so you see more scoring because it's a wider goal.
Yeah, but there's more equipment. Yeah, so
there is more equipment, too.
I don't think they were better players before. I don't know.
Well, I'm telling you, when you got a guy with an expansion like Wayne Gretzky that get 200 points in a season, 92 right. goals, I mean, that's phenomenal.
It's a little
that's
suspect, but he was an amazing player. He's the great one.
He stands alone.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you, Ken. That's your hat trick story. And I do know that now no one's going to throw their hat on the ice because it's too expensive.
You would think, but people still do when you see a hat trick. I mean, Patrick Kane didn't get that many the other night because it was an away game.
I am not
but
throwing
at home,
my Blackhawks
you wouldn't
hat.
Do it?
No, would no. you?
Yeah.
You would not.
I would do it. I'd throw somebody else's hat. I'd find a guy near me, just grab his hat and throw it on there.
Is your name Paxton?
Yes, yes. Wendy, Bill, this goes back to an archetypal year, 1919, after World War One. Start of Prohibition, and I think the Cubs figured in there somewhere, too.
Oh.
But over half the games are played outside.
Yeah.
And so if someone scored two or then it became three goals, they would throw them their hat. They would wear that hat.
The player would wear the hat.
The player would wear the hat, and it also applied to the goalie, who would save three. And so that transferred eventually to three goals. And, you know, the caller previous was right, you know, he was back in the 40s and 50s. They wore hats there, too. But this time, they threw the hat out. The player would wear the damn hat. That's so weird. But that's what happened.
And is this along with, I don't know when helmets came into being, but would they still wear a helmet and a hat, or was it one or the other?
This is 1919, Bill. There were no helmets. There were no face masks.
No, nothing.
Face masks on the goalie. The goalie had nothing either.
Who was the first goalie to wear a face mask?
Jason Voorhees.
Tony Esposito.
Is that true?
Who? I don't know.
Was it Tony?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Probably not. But I used to look at his face on Life magazine. It had all the scars on it. So I probably didn't have. But this is back when no one wore anything, even on top of their head. So this was.
Yeah, they had nothing.
Imagine the danger in that. That's impossible.
Well, the players were slower and the sticks weren't as sharp.
Oh, you know, all right,
so
maybe.
It all evened out.
But still, a puck coming at you at that speed, at that velocity, that could end you, right? That would
right.
be terrible.
But, Bill, the Indians would do it differently with, you know, back on the plains. They would play like bladder ball.
Oh, yeah, all right.
Yeah, so it's all the same.
Yep, I guess so. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, love the show.
Thanks, Paxton. Take care.
Thank you. I like the name, Paxton. Glenn Henry, Mr. Goalie Hall.
Glenn Hall was the goalie, the Hawks' big goalie before Tony Esposito for a bunch of years.
Is that when he was nicknamed Mr. Goalie, first goaltender to develop and make effective use of the butterfly style of goalkeeping? I do not know about the helmet. Why, you know, we're talking all this hat trick and stuff. We should just get like our buddy Doc Emmerich on to talk about all this
stuff.
He
would probably know. My best friend in the whole world, Grant Mulvey, was a Blackhawk for a while. He might know.
Why don't you forget your friends, don't you?
No, I don't want to use up our friendship on something this trivial.
You'd rather save it for a playoff game?
Yep.
I heard you say that in the hall, by the way.
I love Grant Mulvey. He's my best friend in the world, and you're jealous. That's all I'm saying.
When's the last time you talked to him?
Today, this morning.
Liar. Nick, you have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
The hats in the old days had 3 points to them, the front and the two in the back. So that was the 3 points of the hat. That's where the hat trick came from.
They were like revolutionary heroes like that?
No. Just think of the old, like, Humphrey Bogart hats. They had the point in the front, and then there were 2 points in the back. And there, so there were 3 points on the hat, and that's where it came from.
All right. Well, that makes some sense, I guess. Yeah.
How come everybody has a different story?
They're all good. Every one of these stories is good. That makes sense to me.
Thank you, Nick. Now I'm starting to believe because his name is Patrick.
That's why it's called a hat trick. Yeah. It rhymes with his name.
Somebody also texted saying, I think O.J. Simpson is innocent, too. Really? What is... Everybody's so bitter.
I don't get that.
2016, all right. The year of the jerk.
We're...
The jerk store called.
Come on. A break, some news, more show. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
By the way, just found something out from a fantastic texter.
What did they say?
312-981-7200, the phone line and the text line before we talk to Ryan Burrow with Burrow's Bureau. Someone said if you throw your hat on the ice at the UC during a hat trick, you can get it back. They put it at customer service.
Oh, I had no idea. That's a great idea. I didn't know that. Good. Well, score more hat tricks, fellas.
And if you're missing a hat and you need
this is your chance to get a hat.
Yeah, here you go.
Very good.
Oh, yeah.
Go over there and get yourself a free hat.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Texter. Good idea.
And thank you, Ryan. That was very helpful, your report. We appreciate that very much. You're here to talk about what's going on in Flint, Michigan, and boy, is this story crazy. For people who are on up on what's going on with the water in Flint, fill some people in, because this is
insane.
Oh,
black water. I get it.
Yeah.
This all started, actually, in 2014. They were getting their water from Detroit. That's how it was coming into Flint. But they decided, while they tried to set up the new, cheaper way of getting water through Lake Huron, they were going to tap into a river to get their water. That apparently did not work out so well, because immediately after they made the switch over, people were complaining. The water was dirty. It smelled funny. It tasted funny. And people were complaining almost instantaneously when the switchover happened. But they were continually assured that we've tested it. The water seems to be fine.
Safe.
Safe. And unfortunately, as reports, medical reports started coming in, whether it be private citizens or even public health records, that dozens of kids were showing signs of lead in their system as a result of this. So the governor said that he wasn't really made aware of the health situation until October. Obviously, this thing has just kind of started blowing up now over the last month or so.
What did he do in October, though?
Well, that's,
nothing.
That's and that's really what people are trying to get down to. There are a couple things going on. First of all, they got to get people healthy, fresh water. I mean, that's your first priority. Let's get things back on track. Let's get these people safe. And then, of course, behind the scenes, we've got the Department of Justice involved. We've got obviously state legislators involved, lawmakers trying to figure out what the heck happened. And today we found out about some class action lawsuits, which I think we all expected.
What took so long?
Exactly. And people want to know who knew what and when, and who responded and when. Did this take long on purpose? If this had happened, this is as the argument has been pointed out by several people, including Hillary Clinton. If this had happened in a wealthy Detroit suburb, would it have taken this long? You know, I think we all know that Flint is a hardworking class a city with a lot of minorities in it, and you know, perhaps maybe people didn't respond as quickly as they should have.
People have alleged that this was some sort of a money saving issue, that they could get by a lot
cheaper, right?
It was. And remember, the whole thing of drawing the water from Lake Huron was supposed to be cost saving as well. It's just they had to find this temporary solution while they ended the contract with Detroit, and this was supposed to be, you know, filtering the water from the river into whatever filters they used, was supposed to not only save money, but be kind of this stopgap until the hookup could happen. The only problem is, once that water got into the system,
right,
you know, it's really, really hard to get it out. So now who's going to pay
it
to get this water out?
It mucked up the system, as older people would say.
Oh,
it mucked it up. Could you imagine getting water from the Chicago River?
No. I mean, I have problems sometime in the summer walking down there. We saw the stories this summer about grease balls and, you know, fecal matter and stuff like that that's found. I mean, I have a hard time sometimes. I mean, it's a beautiful river, don't get me wrong, but sometimes when you hit it on a sunny day, it's like, oh, wait a minute here, you know.
But there are those fecal grease balls, as they're called, which if there isn't a band, take it somewhere.
There you go.
In Lake Michigan as well.
Maybe it goes through filter systems, right? It's all
so
fine.
They had filter systems. Why wasn't it getting, although it couldn't probably get the lead out?
And this is where the problems lie. And this is why the Justice Department has gotten involved. They want to know who did what, who knew what. And at the time, unfortunately, it was a state government employee who gave the all clear for this to take place. So
do you know where I first heard about this? This is very strange, but you know, Michael Moore, the documentarian.
Yes, I do.
He was one of the first people to say on a national level, hey, rest of the country, we've got a major problem here in Flint, Michigan. Nobody seems to be paying attention to this, but there's lead in our water supply. Why isn't anybody bothered by this?
Yeah, and he's brought the television cameras out, and whether you follow Michael Moore or not, or you believe what he says or not, I mean, he's gone to the extent of he wants the governor arrested.
Yeah.
I mean, he's going to take it very, very extreme because he wants action to be done right now. But in many ways, you're right. This is kind of what brought this to a national spotlight. Now, I can tell you, the mayor of Flint, Michigan, is in Washington, D.C. Sounds like she will meet with the president. The president only has so many resources available to him because this is not, while it is an emergency, it's not a disaster. It's not a tornado. So there are only limited resources that he can bring to the area. And for the most part, we've been seeing, you know, bottled water, filters.
Sure seems like a disaster to me if you can't get fresh water.
Well, we've seen, too, how these declarations are worded. You know, in Illinois, we've seen with tornadoes, it has to hit a certain threshold of damage before federal funds can happen. And, you know, we've also seen, you know, situations where governors and mayors have said, hold on, don't rush to report all of your, you know, your damage because we only get one shot at
right.
this. So, I mean, there are very fine restrictions to be able to get the money that they need.
As of now, Ryan, for the people who are living in Flint, Michigan, what are they doing? Are they still using tap water? Or is everybody not?
They're trying not to. They're hopefully not, because you know, bottled waters are available. They do have water filters. They're even going as far as giving people water tests and blood tests and things like that to make them feel safe. But you know, could you imagine waking up every morning and having to go down to the fire station to get your bottled water for the day? I mean, that's kind of what they're doing. Some of the people don't feel confident in the bathing, so they'll either go rent a hotel or go to, you know, a couple towns over and
yeah, it's
ask
lead.
For showers.
It's not like, you know, it's good to come in contact with.
No.
So, yeah, even showering is something not good. Now, what are the odds that the governor or mayor is going to get some kind of legal ramifications from this, or a sentence?
Yeah, we'll find out. The Department of Justice is involved. Of course, as we've seen here with the police investigation, I mean, these things could take months, years. I mean, who knows until they can pinpoint who it is, who was the problem, did people react soon enough? You know, when these emails become available of public officials emailing each other about the problem.
But Ryan, somebody along the line had to have tested the water for lead. It was somebody's job to put it through the lead test. I mean, if you turn on your tap and pencil are coming out, something's very wrong with your water.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, I'm sure that information is available. It's just a matter of who that information is available to. A lot of the attorneys today who are part of this class action lawsuit says, you know, because of certain restrictions, they can't necessarily go after public information quite yet. But once
really?
They file the lawsuit, now you
then
can
you
go
can.
Into discovery and this kind of stuff can be made public. So the lawsuits are aimed to do a couple things. Obviously, get people some kind of monetary compensation for their problems. They're also trying to get people to step forward and say, hey, have you had any problems with this? Because according to them, they've had people come forward with rash issues. They've had people come forward with hair loss issues. People come forward with miscarriages. Now, they've got to step back and say, well, wait a minute. You know, maybe some of these issues were happening regardless
sure,
of the water. And they've got to kind of figure that stuff out. But in the meantime, they want the public to come forward and say, hey, ever since this happened, this started happening to me, or this started happening to my family.
Right.
So they're trying to find that out. They also want all the people who have had water shutoff notices in the last 2 years. They want that to end because, you know, this has been tainted water.
Yep.
They want the water bills to be, you know, paid back
refunded.
Yeah. You know,
as they should. I mean, can you even imagine this?
No, it's terrible.
I can't imagine the person responsible for this being able to sleep at night.
Well, and we'll find out in due time. I mean, rarely does only one person know about something, you know, so
yeah.
We'll see how far this.
Could Steve Avery have anything to do with this, do you think?
Will you watch that? Because I am dying to talk to you about
right,
the
I'll
making of
up.
A murderer.
I'll finish it up.
I am going nuts.
I know. It's almost done. Well, this is an ugly situation in Flint, Michigan. There's no question about it, Ryan. Thanks very much for being here.
No,
really appreciate it.
No problem.
That.
Michigan State of the State addresses tonight, so you better
It'll
believe
come up,
the
you
governor's.
Think?
Yeah, I would think so. He's already called it a disaster. So.
Yeah, it is a disaster. Yeah. It's terrible. That's Ryan Burrow.
Thank you,
we'll
Ryan.
Be back in just a little bit. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Again, our heart's going out to the people of Flint, Michigan, who can't even get any decent water. We just talked to Ryan Burrow about the situation there in Flint where there's lead, among other things, in the water that's coming into people's homes. They can't drink it. They can't shower in it. They can't bathe in it.
They
it's
can't give it to their pets.
Right.
Somebody just texted us and said, One guy in Flint said his water bill is $160 a month, which is high.
Yeah, that seems high.
That's high.
Yeah.
And he can't even give it to his dog. People are afraid to bathe in it. 630 says, I read that Cher donated bottles of water with a company. Is that true?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe. That's nice of her.
Why, is she
true.
From there?
No, I don't think she is. Cher from Sonny and Cher?
Yeah, no. I know Madonna's from Michigan, not right. Flint, but you know she should be doing it.
Madonna's from the British part of Michigan, where she is. But they
so
all have
funny.
British accents.
We were talking about the Blackhawks a little bit. You heard about this man who designed the Bulls logo 50 years ago. Did you hear this in the news?
This is crazy. Yeah, tell everybody what this is, because this is unbelievable.
All right, there's a guy who is no longer with us. He passed away in 2004 at the age of 84, but his daughter, Karen Wessel, is telling the story of her dad, Dean Wessel. He's the man who created the Bulls' iconic logo.
Mm-hmm.
And every time Karen Wessel tunes into a Bulls home game from her Alaska home, she can see her father's spirit right at center court. Wessel's father, Dean, is the man who designed that Bulls logo 50 years ago. His payment, are you ready for this?
Yep.
Free tickets to the new franchise's games, but he never got any royalties. He never saw a dime, says his daughter, and he kicked himself in his older age and wished he would have done something to make his life easier. But really, when it gets down to what one's legacy is, if you've lived a good life, you've been a good man, it's a lot better than to make a lot of money, says Karen Wessel. That's nice of her to say. But really, Dean Wessel designed that Bulls logo, and his daughter is just saying...
All he got was some tickets.
Yeah, and it wasn't even season
50 years
tickets.
Ago.
Some free tickets
right.
to the new franchise's games. And, I mean, what do you ask for when somebody says, hey, can I use your thing? This is 50 years ago. You're not going to draw up a contract and ask for $1 million. This is 50 years ago.
I'm sure 50 years ago he probably wasn't thinking that they would use essentially the same logo for this many years. And it is. It's almost unchanged since he first designed it 50 years ago. I didn't really realize this. I was hearing the story this morning on Steve Cochran's show, and they were describing the Bulls logo, and they said something like the blood-soaked horns. And there are red. If you look at the horns of the bull, there is red on there, and I've seen it 1,000 times in my life. I've never, for some reason, equated that
Me
with
neither.
Being blood. I just thought that's the team's colors, so it's like an accent color at the end of the horns. But that's blood. That's the blood of their opponents.
Well, it's funny because I heard that same report on the Steve Cochran show, but now I'm reading from DNAinfo.com. Dean Wessel, a professional advertising designer, created the iconic logo, a red face with red-tipped horns.
Yeah.
As a favor to his friend and fellow Little League coach, Bulls founder Dick Klein.
Mm-hmm.
So he just said, yeah, I never...
One friend doing another friend a favor... help out the team. Can you draw up something? We might use it as the logo. Let's see how it looks. But you got to be a little bit savvier and go, if you're going to use this, let's make an agreement. I mean, maybe tickets were a nice thing for him, but like we said, the same logo for 50 years over and over and over, you deserve a little bit more.
And imagine every single solitary item between t-shirts and sweatpants and hats and car flags.
Everything.
And bath mats.
Right.
And keychains.
Garage doors. I've
everything.
Seen it on garage doors.
I still don't think that's blood.
What else could it be? A bull uses their horns.
I know what a bull uses his horns for.
For destruction and evil. So... What else could that be?
Evenly spaced. If I was a bull and I was horning someone, it wouldn't be even on both sides.
This is a game. If you're new to the show, this is a game Wendy and I play called What Would You Do If You Were a Bull? We do this from time to time. Well, I think it's even out of convenience. It would look really weird if you just had a bunch of blood on one horn and just a little speck on the other.
But it's not like it's droplets. It's just it's painted red because you needed a little red up there. Otherwise, the white horn would get mixed into the white
right.
background.
But if the red did represent something, I guess.
It means he's mad. He's mad.
You think he's blushing?
No, I think that's, it's boiling mad.
That's the blood of an L.A. Lakers, what that is. That's the blood of Kobe Bryant and so many others over the years.
It is a mean bull. I didn't really
realize. Yeah. It's a unibrow bull. He's got the one eyebrow. That's why he's so mad. Looks like Leonid Brezhnev. He's furious. But this guy, the point of this is...
What do you ask for, though, 50 years ago? You never would have said, give me $1 million.
Right, because he wouldn't have got it.
No. I mean, and even, like, you did you think 50 years ago about some kind of royalty that they would be using this? If you use this beyond 20 years, I get a profit of the proceeds. He didn't think for a minute they'd still be using it.
But how many times have we heard stories about people who work for a company and they come up with something?
The guy who invented the television remote.
Right, that's a great example.
And some other guy said, no, I invented the television remote, and I thought neither of them ended up getting money.
I don't remember how that played out. But I remember, because think about what a staple that is in the world, the TV remote. Some guy came up with it and walked away with nothing. I'm trying to remember who I talked about. When I was working before you were here, I talked to somebody who invented a game, and I can't remember if it was Operation or something.
It was Operation.
Was it Operation?
Yeah.
And he got...
I think I was here.
Were
Thanks
you here for
remembering.
That? I don't remember. There was some woman sitting there with blonde hair. I don't know who it was. People come in. Didn't they walk away with like $200 for inventing Operation?
Yeah, and look at how many spinoffs. We had him on because this was 2014.
Oh,
I was
okay.
here.
Yeah, well,
he was
here
77. John Spinello, he sold the game for $500 and the promise of a job.
Right.
And he needed surgery back then and couldn't afford the procedure. So Hasbro has jumped in and they did say it would help.
Oh, they did. Okay.
But yeah, he got $500, and look at all the different...
They've sold hundreds of millions of Operation games,
and all the spinoffs.
Away. I know.
Like SpongeBob
right.
Operation.
Homer Simpson Operation, Fred Flintstone Operation. There's been a bunch of them over the years.
What, do you have them all?
Yes.
You should pay this guy.
I might have to. I might have to. So all we're saying, Bulls, Jimmy Butler, he's a friend of mine, you know, Wendy. We do each other's hair. Get this guy some money. He invented your logo. He deserves something. His family. I know he's no longer with us.
No, he's not, and his daughter's living in Alaska, but I'm sorry, it's red-tipped horns.
But
it says red-tipped,
but it's
not
blood-tipped. You don't think it's blood?
If you didn't hear that report mentioned the blood-tipped horns this
morning... I wouldn't
have
wanted to think it was blood, that's true.
You wouldn't have even thought it was blood.
Right. I would have thought it was, like, ketchup or something. Bulls love ketchup. You know that, right? That's their favorite food. Bulls go nuts for ketchup. That's a common... Everyone knows that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll find out. I think Ro and Anna are actually at the United Center, are they not?
Going
I think
for 12 in a row tonight?
12 straight for the Blackhawks. That's what we're all hoping for. So we'll take a quick break. We'll come back, close off the show, and turn it over to Ro and Anna next. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.